Blog Talk Radio.
Walk by sight, not by faith.
Exactly, exactly. Welcome, Mandy. Good morning. Well, good afternoon, rather.
Good afternoon, and I am so happy to be here on the show. Thank you very much for, thank you all for welcoming me as a permanent part of the show now, and I'm very happy to tackle subjects and figure out how we can all work together on in the free thought movement and how to proceed in the future.
Exactly, exactly. There's so many topics that needs to be, you know, they need to be addressed. And I'm just looking forward to moving forward in a new era in which we are able to address these issues and discuss it within a free thought community. And just be able to share our views and allow, you know, our callers to share their views. And we can, you know, we may not agree, but everyone is entitled to their own opinion and their own voice. And we want to be an outlet so that people can voice their opinions and, you know, state their case or what have you. Because, again, it's inclusive. We're inclusive. We want everyone to know that they are definitely a part of the show.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, so today we wanted to talk a little bit about the Troy Davis case. And there were several other cases that are kind of linked here, but particularly the Troy Davis case. That particular case has evoked so many emotions all over Facebook, Twitter, the bloggers. I've just seen a lot of emotions come out about this case, and everyone seems to have something to say about it. And I guess my question to many people is, moving forward, are we going to continue to hold an apathetic type of position, or are we going to be action-based, action-oriented? Are we going to move forth to make sure that no other person will be in that particular position? Are we going to educate others, our children, and, you know, other children around us? What to do and what not to do if they're ever in a situation like that and they happen to be innocent, or if they are guilty, on educate them on how to proceed so that, you know, it's really interesting. But, yeah, we need to make people aware of the laws. But in regards to this case, again, a lot of emotions were brought forth, especially at the last minute. And this has been going on for a while because this young man had four appeals. His case was appealed four times, and particularly in 2009, he had a stay of execution then. And I guess my question to some of these people is, you know, I know some of them are new to the case because many people didn't know who he was or what had happened. I guess my question is, those who have been following this case for a while, what took them so long to make us aware of it?
Right, absolutely. And if I would like to add to this as well, especially to the black community and everyone who has been crying race foul, that this is another case of another innocent black man being lynched by the justice system, and that, you know, this is a cry for injustice everywhere. I'm concerned that we as a community are not being objective and also subjective about the cases that are presented to us. Because just going by what is being said in the media is very irresponsible. Like, for example, it has been said that there has been no evidence presented whatsoever in this case, and that is simply not true. If you take a look at the report and take a look into the research, there was ballistic evidence recovered that was presented against Troy Davis in this case. And as far as the witnesses that recanted against him, what has to be looked at is who actually recanted against him. And one important thing that is being left out is that the two main witnesses against him, which was the gentleman who went to the police initially, as well as the other gentleman who Troy Davis shot in the face, and for those who don't know, he was accused and convicted of allegedly shooting someone in the face that same night. Those two gentlemen have not recanted their testimony. And also, as well, the appeals that have been filed against, for the state on Troy Davis's behalf. One of the first appeals was that the jury was not favorable to his trial. And again, for those who don't know, the jury was comprised of 7 blacks and 5 whites. So they ruled against them on that. And unfortunately, yes, we do have to take a look at this through the eyes of the legal system. When losing appeals or losing cases are presented, it sets bad legal precedents, especially when they are investigated and they are found to be, let's say, for lack of a better word, faulty.
Exactly.
Because so many people are trying to cry race foul on this, and there are so many factors that indicate otherwise in this case. So I'm concerned that the community at large is not looking deeper into the issues, and also which cases we put on the forefront of racial injustice.
Exactly. And there was a reason why I mentioned 2009, because in 2009 the Supreme Court ordered the District Court of Georgia to consider whether new evidence that, quote, that could have been obtained at the time of trial clearly establishes Davis's innocence, end quote. And so there was an evidentiary hearing held in June of 2010. The issue is his attorneys were not able to prove his innocence. Now, whether he did it or not, I don't know. I wasn't there. But what I'm saying is that he had 4 appeals. The last evidentiary hearing was held in June of 2010. That evidence should have been shown at that time. And while I do agree that once those witnesses recanted their statements, he should have been granted a new trial, again, they didn't necessarily have to grant him a new trial, and they didn't. And they executed him. Now, whether they executed an innocent man or not, I'll never quite be sure because, again, I wasn't there that evening. But evidence points to him clearly being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Absolutely.
And so, we need to take a look at all of this. And, there are timelines out there as to what was happening, because he also made an appeal March of this year, March of 2011, and the appeal was rejected in January of this year. He filed a new appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. And, again, it's just we need to take a look at everything, because the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, they again denied his last-minute bid for clemency in this respect. And I'm not saying that the judicial system has always been fair, because it hasn't.
Absolutely.
And there are ways some of these judges are elected. So what we need to do is galvanize support to find out exactly who is elected to some of these boards and some of these judicial positions, because some are appointed and some are elected. The ones that were elected, if you don't believe in some of their rulings, then what you need to do is vote them out. Vote them out. Educate yourself on the issues. Educate yourself on the people that you're voting in or voting out. But most importantly, you need to register to vote.
Yes.
Walking around complaining about this case, they are not registered to vote, and in addition to that, you can't serve on a jury unless you are registered to vote. So you have to do your part, too.
Yes, that is absolutely right.
Exactly. So it's just important that we take a look at this in the most objective way possible. Again, you know, we're not the judge, we're not the jury, we're not condemning him, but we're also not absolving him either. I just want people to try not to look at this from an emotional standpoint, not to try to look at this from a reactive standpoint, but try to be more proactive, because there are going to be more people. There have been a lot of innocent people incarcerated, and with a lot of these Project Innocence groups and other groups with the DNA evidence, you know, they're freeing people who were wrongfully indicted and wrongfully convicted of crimes. Then we need to support them, get involved in some of these groups, and try to help the people that have been unfairly incarcerated. We have to do our part.
Right, and absolutely, Kim. And I would also like to add that while the historical aspect of the justice system against us is, you know, is very heavy, and, you know, it's something that does need to be taken into consideration. There's no doubt about that. I just think that in order, we do need to learn from these. We need to learn lessons from this. And continue to be objective. We cannot hold on to the baggage. If we're not learning from it, then we continue to we stunt our objectivity as a community, and we don't hold people accountable for their actions responsibly. And that still has to happen, regardless of the historical aspect of of this.
Exactly. Exactly, and that's very true. And Nell Turner there, she said, "I can't defend anyone's guilt or innocence if I'm not there. However, if this man was guilty, he didn't deserve the death penalty if there wasn't sufficient evidence. And that is correct, if there wasn't sufficient evidence. But what we have to remember is not everything is privy to the public.
Right, so there absolutely.
There may be evidence that we don't know about, again. You know, so I'm not justifying anything. All I'm saying is without all of the evidence in front of me, it's really hard for me to say whether or not he's innocent or guilty, and that's not my job. It's not my job to do that. You know, my job is to, you know, bring what the information that I have and try to educate people on the judicial system. I can't educate you on this case, because I don't have all of the information in front of me, but I know what I've read, and not necessarily what I've read in blogs, but I've gone and I've done a little bit of research on this particular case. And, again, you know, there is a lot of information that is being overlooked. It's available. It's public information. It's available, but people are overlooking these things, you know, and I can refer back to, you know, what Mandy had spoken on a few minutes ago, the ballistics in this case. And the ballistics in the case pointed to Troy. Now, I'm not saying that the evidence could not have been tampered with. We have seen situations in which that has been the case. But if that was the case, then it was incumbent upon his attorneys to bring that evidence to light.
Absolutely, Kim. And also one thing that needs to be understood, and this is something that can be looked at either way, but this may be something that people don't know about. And this goes towards, you know, this goes towards the appearance of impropriety or appearance of guilt. People may not know that Troy Davis fled the jurisdiction right after the murder took place. Now, in a court of law or a court of public opinion, that could or could not make him look guilty. However, this is something that needs to be taken into consideration. All of these instances need to be looked at and looked at objectively.
Exactly, exactly. Because people started referring to and talking about the Humberto Leal Garcia case, in which the Obama administration called to Texas to Governor Rick Perry and was asking for a stay of execution for Mr. Garcia. And the Supreme Court of the United States, as well as Rick Perry, they both ignored the Obama administration in that case. The only reason why the Obama administration got involved in that particular case is because they felt that it would damage diplomatic relations with Mexico. That is the only reason why he called in for that particular case. But again, it takes me back to the 14th Amendment in that particular instance or any of these instances. Why aren't these, you know, administrations or presidents invoking the 14th Amendment, the Supremacy Clause in the 14th Amendment?
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was also going to say in reading in that case as well, that Garcia was not informed of his right to notify the Mexican consulate. Now, I don't know if that immediately violates his rights, but if it does, then I can certainly understand why Obama had, or the administration was also, I think they brought that up in appeal as well,
mm-hmm.
but that would certainly mm-hmm. warrant reconsideration
exactly.
as well.
That's very true, very true. And GE said Judge Mathis, exactly, Judge Mathis agreed that the minute that these witnesses recanted their testimony, that Troy Davis should have been granted a new trial. I agree with that.
Yes,
however,
I agree on that as well. I definitely think that it definitely should have, I definitely think that it should have been given more consideration. However, understanding it from the legal standpoint, putting myself in the shoes of the judges and the attorneys, or for the state of Georgia, all going back to what I said about who did and did not recant. The main witnesses against him didn't recant. And, of course,
exactly,
they are looking at why they didn't.
Exactly, exactly. And one of the theories, again, and I'll call it a theory, that I've seen online is that some of the witnesses are stating that the main witness against Troy was the actual murderer and had threatened them. And so how true that is, I don't know. And I won't pretend to have any type of inside information on that. But if that is indeed true, then, yes, Troy definitely should have been granted a new trial.
Yeah.
And there should have been some
an investigation into that.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's just, it's really interesting because, again, you know, he's been, this particular case has been around a while, since 1989.
Mm-hmm.
This has been happening since 1989, and again, they gave him a stay of execution in 2009. You know, now I'm looking at his attorneys. Where did they fail?
Right. Right. And I'm in reading up on this case, I think the types of appeals they were filing, for one, may have contributed to the failure because, for one, again, like I said before, they tried to challenge the racial makeup of the jury, trying to cite that he wasn't given a fair trial that way, as well as the venue. Now, Savannah is kind of a small town. It's not as big of it as Atlanta. And the venue could be called into question, certainly. But I think it's possible that it is a large enough city to where you could find impartiality. I'm not saying that, you know, of course, you know, the kind of the South, you know, not saying that they are totally, would totally be objective, you know, in a case like this. But certainly the makeup of the jury, you know, they could not reasonably argue racial disparity there, especially with the makeup. And then, two, he also challenged the electric chair as cruel and unusual punishment for the death penalty. I personally do not understand what that would have to do with the method. Now, the death sentence in general, yes, but the means and method of execution, I don't understand why that would be brought up.
Right, right, exactly, exactly. And it's just, it's really interesting, you know, this whole case. And basically, you know, I just want people to take a lesson from this and, again, galvanize themselves to possibly, you know, go forth and become, again, action-oriented. Become action-oriented and get out here and, you know, educate themselves as well as educate people, you know, other people on the law so that if another case such as this arises, they'll know what to do. They'll know what course of action to take. You know, the lawyers for Troy Davis, they should just be fired. You know, and I won't say that they should be disbarred, but they definitely should be given a side eye.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would get several opportunities, and I'm not quite sure where the disconnect is or where the breakdown is. But in this particular case, if that young man was innocent, then they failed him.
Yeah. Yes, I do agree there. And also I'd like to say that, yes, for those in the chat room who were saying how a police officer was killed, and, yes, when a cop is killed, yes, the law enforcement community does, they do galvanize, and they do try to find the perpetrators as soon as possible. There are a lot of emotions involved on their end when a police officer is killed. However, I do find that people are forgetting in the manner in which this particular police officer was killed. And I find it very disturbing that there are some black people who forget that, where is their compassion for the victim in this case? You know, I mean, this officer, as much as we know a lot of butthole cops, this particular officer was working a second job to support his two young children and his family. And in the process of trying to break up a fight, he was shot first in the heart and in the face. I would feel empathy for anybody, black, white, or whatever, who went through that type of suffering. And where does that, you know, where does that come in? Because no one deserves to die like that. No one.
Exactly. Exactly. And going back to what I was saying in regards to his jury, his peers. There were seven blacks on the jury. So what do we do about, you know, how do we handle that? I don't believe that this is a case about race. I believe that this was a case about a young man, unfortunately, of ill repute. And while that should not have anything to do with him being convicted, because, again, that should be factored into it, but unfortunately that happened. And it's about moving forward. It's because what's done is done. We can't go back and change anything. We can't go back and change anything. We just have to move forward. And what are we going to do as individuals, as a community? How are we going to move forward and make sure things like this never happen again? I believe I have Funny to the Moon on the line. I think they're here.
Hello,
Travis,
Kim.
Are you there? Hey, good afternoon.
We are.
Hello, Kim. How are you?
We're doing well. Tane, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. You know, I'm listening to what you're saying, and you know the truth about the whole death penalty thing is, we've seen some people talk about it this week, and the real truth is, it is not a black white thing. It's a rich poor thing all the way. And if you're poor and white, you'll be fried up in a chair too, or get an ejection. And I was watching. There's a video I was watching with Dick Gregory. Everybody know who Dick Gregory is?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick Gregory was in a black church, and he asked them. He said, "How many of y'all for the death penalty?" And some clapped. And he said, "Why? It's only used against you." He said, Prince Charles would come in here and kill all y'all and wouldn't get the death penalty. like that.
Exactly.
And that's the truth. If you're rich, or if you're wealthy and are willing to take a chunk of your dough and fight the case, you won't get the death penalty no matter what you did.
So, Travis, let me ask you this question. The gentleman who was executed the same day as Davis for dragging the black man to his death, and I think it was some time ago back in the 80s, was he,
yeah.
Do we know if he was rich or poor, or because he was white, and he was convicted and given the death penalty?
Well,
so, I mean,
I
I'm just asking the question.
if I was going to guess, I would say he was poor,
mm-hmm.
because rich white people don't go around randomly killing black folks. Rich
that
white
is
people
true.
Just put their foot on the neck of folks with interest rates and things like that. Right?
Well,
when you were talking also about the police officer and people were acting like, you know, good, you know, once in a while we need to get even on the streets, you know, as much as cops F with the ghettos, and, you know, every once in a while a cop gets killed or gets in an accident, and you'll see people in the ghetto be like, yeah, good, right? I could give an F about a cop. But that's the problem with our system and the way we punish is that it causes people to want punishment. You know, it breeds, it's like, you know, when they say an abused child has a higher percentage of becoming an abuser themselves. And it seems counterintuitive that you wouldn't do what to someone else what you hated being done to you, would you?
Exactly. Right. Right. That's what I'm saying. Where's the empathy here? You know, yes, we do for all victims of crimes. We want, you know, there should be justice for all of them. Especially if it is in the line, especially if they were trying to do something right or they were, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time or what have you. We would want justice for all of them.
The problem is on all sides is that the good folks don't stand up against the bad folks, meaning the good cops remain a little bit too quiet on what the bad cops do, you know? Okay, and does that make sense? Same thing, that's across the board, okay? And all, meaning my father said to me, good and bad people come in all colors. So if I'm sitting around thinking that everybody black is good, then somebody black's going to clunk me in the head and take my stuff, okay? If I think everybody white is bad, then I'm going to miss out on some friendships.
Mm-hmm.
That would be great for my life. Okay, and the
bad.
Same thing. You act like all cops are bad, and then, but that is the same thing. If you look like the way Tony Bennett was talking about 9/11, and said that we as Americans have had things done in our name all over the globe, and they mentioned on Bill Maher about how there's a 150 countries with, you know, that with a military presence, with a U.S. military presence in it, which makes us an empire. So then when things like 9/11 happen, yeah, somebody someplace else might cheer because they're thinking, finally, some of them got something. You know what I mean? It'd be like if you were a person who hung out with the bully. You're friends with the bully. And then one day you're walking down the street by yourself and somebody sees you and they're like, hey, ain't that the friend of the bully? And then they go whoop your ass.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
They can't get to the bully.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
Right.
It happens every day. Go ahead.
All the time.
Exactly. And in this particular case, again, you know, we can't, it's not about color. And, you know, I can agree, you know, that poor people who are economically and educationally disadvantaged are basically, they fall victim and are at the wheel of what I consider as great pretenders, also known as, you know, defenders, you know, public defenders or public pretenders, if you will. And,
mm-hmm.
again, most of them are not competent. I mean, I'll just put it out there. I believe that most public defenders are not the most competent people, most competent attorneys out there. And in many cases, all they're trying to do is get their client to plead to anything because they're trying to get the case, you know, off the table, because most of them are overrun and inundated with cases as it is. So many of them are overworked and underpaid. So in many cases, they don't have enough time to do the proper research And when you're researching torts or researching case law, it takes time, you know. But again, if you have paralegals and legal researchers on your staff, that's their job. But again, you know, with them cutting budget and in some cases just not budgeting for it at all, you know, where does the disconnect lie? You know, because there are people who are innocent that are incarcerated. I'll acknowledge that. But in this case, in this case right here, again, why wasn't all of this evidence presented when they had the opportunity?
And where was the protest before the last minute?
Right.
What is this slow roll, wait till somebody's almost, wait till they got the syringe filled with poison before people start getting loud? What is this? Where are we?
A couple of things that you said. One is a good point is that now I lost my train of thought. How do we feel about the death penalty? Don't they say that it's cheaper to actually keep somebody in jail for life than to go through the process and the court proceedings of an execution?
From what I understand, that is true. I think it is cheaper to keep someone. I think it's very expensive to house death row inmates. And with the appeals process or what have you, because it takes a long time. Like this actually, the Davis, this is actually very typical of death penalty cases, that these appeals get dragged out for decades.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
It takes a while for it to get to the point where the person is actually executed.
Well, I think another real big part of the system, which I don't know why there isn't more bravery towards this part of law, but when you find that these law students, you know, they take on cases that are fishy where the people have been convicted and they actually find them innocent, you know, there's a whole group people that do that, yeah, like amnesty type movements that try to find innocents and get them out of jail. And when they do, many times, why did the person get into jail? There was rampant corruption, manipulation of the evidence, a judge was on the take, etc. And what's weird is these people get released, they get a new court date, they're proven to be innocent, whether it's new DNA or whatever. And none of the other cases or behavior of all of these people found to have cheated and lied to this guy, getting him in prison, right, from the prosecutor to the public defender, right, they were sloppy, they were lazy, they doctored evidence, they hid evidence. Don't you have to go back to what all these cops and judges did and go, look, you know what, if we caught you doing it this time, we got to review all your cases.
All of
how many
them.
Times?
Mm-hmm.
But we don't do that. We go, oh, well, and then we interview these people, and they say, well, you know, it's such a workload. Things slip through the cracks. We couldn't possibly look at every single document of every single blah, blah, blah.
You're right, Tana. I think that if there is a sign that somebody has been falsely imprisoned, falsely convicted, you know, a trumped-up case, then the effort put into finding out if those people did that to anybody else should be the same as when there's a missing child. Because
if you find three bodies in their house, you got to check, well, look, we got 10 other unsolved body cases. Let's run this MF DNA through those cases because we found some bodies here. And it's so why wouldn't you go, well, this DA cheated this guy in this case, in the death row case, and he's innocent. Let's look into what this DA is doing. Let's see how this sheriff is rolling, right? You can catch somebody like that, but there isn't.
Right, but that would be asking investigators to invest themselves, or you'd have to figure out some type of publicly funded way that, well, all right, you found a corrupt DA, then you got to go through all his stuff, all of it.
Yeah, also, too, though, I would like to add, though, so.
They need to be afraid to do it again is what he said, I think. Yeah, go ahead. What'd you say?
You know what, man? I'm not going to give up these fingerprints. I'm not going to give up this other case that would help the guy. And we got to have these people talking like, hey, man, I wouldn't do that because you're going to get one of these law school student programs that's going to dig through this shit in a couple of years, and you're going to go down. So I wouldn't even, right? They're not even afraid because they know there's nothing coming if they get caught.
Yeah, but also, too, how do you think that the, quote-unquote, no snitching rule in the black community helps or does not help with these cases? Because that also plays a factor as well. Everything that y'all said was absolutely true, and that does garner a lot of merit. However, when we have this rule in our community that we're not going to snitch on people, that we're not going to, you know, we're not going to give them up to the cops, we're going to hinder the investigation, how does that help at all?
Exactly.
Well, I think you need to make I think we need some ridicule in order to flip it the other way, because calling somebody a tattletale has been built into us to have us not do that. So you need to flip it, and basically, if you don't snitch, you become the perpetrator's bitch. You didn't do it like that.
Exactly.
Okay. And
also, I think to help with that, we need, it's almost like they could start a program, it'd almost be like a placebo program, where it isn't real to the cops, but it is to the community. And what they do is sneak in certain plainclothes cops and tell them that they are the ones to talk to about the other cops. It's a new program. Like, we're the internal affairs to make sure that the cops in your neighborhood are doing you guys right, and we're going to walk around, we got tattoos and shit, and we're eating like that. So then the community knows, and they'll at least have some sense of trust. Listen, if you need to, if you need to report something, you know, don't call the cops. Call Harry, you know.
Call
the like, if you're scared of gangs, they don't want to call no cops.
And, you know, that would, Dana, that plan would work if there was more of a community and people – when people couldn't travel as easy, then people kind of stayed where they were, and you knew everybody, so you knew who you could talk to, and it would be safe. But now people are so spread out that they got it where you don't even know your neighbor.
Yeah.
So how would
you
know that?
That there's somebody that is on our side that does care about justice, because that's why we don't. In the ghetto, that's why we don't tell on each other to the cops, because we don't trust the cops.
Mm-hmm.
The cops could do something worse, or the cops could try to pull your ass in. And you see, you're just trying to report a crime.
Mm-hmm.
So
unfortunately, it kind of becomes a vicious cycle, though, to an extent. Nothing gets better because there is no trust of the cops or of the community, and nothing gets better. Because yes, there are some of these gang leaders or gang bangers or whatever that are informants for the cops, and they are, you know, letting them off on certain charges so they can help them with other charges. And yes, then other crimes are either swept under the rug or they get lesser sentences for them. But I just think that overall, you know, when there is that breakdown and there is no attempt to even try, then it doesn't get any better.
Right. Now, and in that case, the way that I see it is, if people don't want to cooperate with the police or report crime, you know, that's happening in their community, then I feel that they silence themselves. You know, why are you complaining when you're part of the problem?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you should just call the cops, and that's the problem is there's so much other stuff going on in the ghetto that people don't want to bring, you might want them to get rid of the guy shooting off guns in the yard next door,
mm-hmm.
but you don't want them coming over and checking out your spot and finding your weed or, you know, the car parts you got from Tony.
Right.
Your garage. Right? You ain't trying to, like, people in the ghetto don't want the cops around. They just want them to come and, like, clear up the more dangerous stuff. And that's the dilemma is, like...
Right, get rid of the crack, but leave the weed alone.
I want to call the cops on these gunshots, but then they're going to ask about my little tire business in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their job. I mean, that's their job, whether you like it or not.
That's why you're
Right.
Like everybody's so unclean, you know, everybody's out doing something that
right.
You're never excited that when the lights come into the neighborhood. You're never happy. You're like, oh, man.
Right, because you call the cops, they might notice that your tabs are expired,
and you
can't get to work tomorrow. You know, you just are trying to be able to walk to the store without getting robbed, but now you can't. You know,
gonna ask me about my 6-year-old warrants and clown me and shit. Right, it's like people don't want to deal with shit like
it's crazy.
Like
right.
Cops, and so that's another angle to it too. Is like I wish. Cops have, see, people don't believe in poor areas that cops are anti-crime and pro-justice. We in poor areas feel like cops just like to fuck with poor people. All we think they are bullies. We don't think that they're cape crusaders like a rich neighborhood. These, wow, you guys came really quick. You know, I have some, would you like some coffee? And we just heard the alarm and thank you for being here. Like, to rich people, they are superheroes. To poor
people, but what do you think,
and
I may be playing devil's advocate here, but what do you expect them to think that whenever they come to the poor neighborhoods and people are not telling what's really going on? How do you expect them to care? How do you expect them to help improve the neighborhoods if everybody's not snitching?
It goes both ways. I mean, once they clunk somebody in the head once, then you ain't going to be too happy about giving them any information. They might clunk you in the head. I mean, if you see somebody get clunked in the head for what you deem is no reason, you're not really going up to go talk to the clunker.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. Again, it just goes back to this vicious cycle. And,
vicious.
You know, it almost seems that it could be unresolved, but I think it could to some, or, you know, it's not going to be overnight. But.
No, and that's the thing. Something that takes.
I was an alien, and they were showing me this sort of acting stage, a recreation of, like, you know, human life here on Earth, and they're just asking me questions about these acts, and they're showing cops. Here come the cops, the sticks, guns on their waist, and then here come citizens out of their houses, and they're gathering on the streets, and you can tell it's getting kind of confrontational, and voices are getting louder, and they pause the video, and they're saying, okay, Tana, who do you think should behave far more, like, generously, you know, peacefully, creatively than the other side? And I would say right away, the people with the guns on should be the angels, right? And if something's about to happen, I'm going to say that the people with the guns should overdo the peace, overdo the niceness, overdo the patience, because they're obviously the people that can cause the most ruckus.
And they work for the other people. The other people pay their salaries.
They don't do that. They go crazier than a mom standing outside holding their baby. They go crazier. And I go, you guys, that's not what an alien would not think that. An alien would think, well, obviously, they've been trained. Look at the weapons they carry. That must come along with understanding, right? Knowing how to talk to people, calm, rational people. Like, it's the opposite. It's like
a gang of wannabe football players.
Man, I mean, it's like if I'm wearing the gun, you can yell and scream and call me all kinds of honky cracker, copper pigs. I'm just like, I got the gun on, motherfucker. I'm trained. I'm like, obviously that does nothing to me, but it's easy to get a cop going. It's easy. You don't even know what you said. You're trying to be just a baby smartass.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, didn't you already ask me that? Excuse me? And you're like, yeah, motherfucker.
Yep.
So those are, there's some problems with the relationship, definitely.
And what she's saying about the apathy versus, I forgot the title of the show. Apathy versus org. Apathy is a lot easier than action, especially when it is obvious that the action needed to be taken is going to take a decade. Okay, to clean up the relationship between the people and the police would take an actual hard working decade of work to, you know, to, you know, I mean, how many questions you got to ask to filter out all the corruption, first of all? And then once you did that, and then once you started doing that, then maybe you could get people to start opening up. You know, okay, I know y'all are getting, you know, I saw that y'all got rid of 20 bad cops, you know, last year. So I'm beginning to feel a little bit more open with talking to y'all, because I know if somebody does something bad, they know that somebody's going to be coming for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, and that went back to the original thing. If you are a crooked judge or a crooked DA, and there's nobody coming after you, what is to stop you from keeping doing what you're doing?
Man, I mean, you watch these. There was one of these shows where there, you know, the guy that got off death row, and they were interviewing the sheriff. And the sheriff was this real, you know, hard-nosed, kind of like our Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona, just like old gunslinger type of sheriff, asshole. And, you know, hid evidence, didn't pursue other avenues to solve the crime, really went for this guy and then got him in jail, convicted him, and then, of course, he got out later. So they're interviewing the sheriff, who now we found out he knows he did all this wrong shit and everything. And when they interviewed him, he was like, well, you know, it's how it goes sometimes. You know, there's just too many cases. You know, what am I supposed to do? Not be a cop? And, like, his arrogant, he wasn't like, man, you know, sometimes things slip through the cracks. I feel awful about this case. You know, man lost his freedom. I was wrong. They don't talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, they still have their chest out. And somebody lost, like, 15 years of their life. And that doesn't even affect them. And to me, these are, like, psychopaths almost. To know what you – it's like, man, you put a man in a cage for 10 years, and how do you feel about it? Oh, he's doing my job. He's doing my job. What am I supposed to do? I go, fuck, feel bad, motherfucker, mistake-making dickhead.
Right.
The system,
wow.
The system is the only thing that's going to make them feel bad. If the system doesn't make them, they're not going to. They can. I mean, this motherfucker's on TV. Talking about, what do you want me to do about it?
The same thing with Rumsfeld when they asked him, you know, or any of these people, knowing now that Saddam didn't have any stuff, do you feel bad? Nope. You know, I got to volunteer. They volunteered to die. I mean, God.
Wow. Well,
so
it's really
one problem with this.
I was just saying that the whole thing is just really interesting, just looking at all of this. But, again, it goes back to, you know, something that we've stated before, how it's all a numbers game. In regards to, you know, whether we send children to the military, send them to prison, or basically subject them just to a life of poverty. And it's a numbers game. And Gio here in the chat room, he was stating, he said, did you know that future prison demand is based on fourth grade dropout rates? And these people use projections, they use forecasting software, all of that type of, you know, technology to basically calculate the number of children that will be coming in and out of the penal system. And some of these prisons are privately owned, and they're being traded on, you know, the stock exchange. And these are things that we need to know. But going back to this here, again, moving forward, what are we going to do? There are more cases like this out here. So the question is, you know, are people going to start moving forward and getting involved in, like, Project Innocence, Amnesty International, and other organizations out there trying to prove the innocence of some of these people who are wrongfully incarcerated?
You're absolutely right, Kim. I mean, Troy Davis is gone. So who are the next 20 Troy Davises that we don't know their name right now that are a tiptoe from a chair or an injection?
Right. Or even if they're not on death row to begin with, the prison population is still cluttered with overwhelmingly with black men, period. And these, especially if they have felonies on their records, they won't be allowed to vote. They will not be allowed to participate in the other liberties, especially when regarding the judicial process that we enjoy. So the education on the law and also how we are perceived in the eyes of certain people to our boys and to our children, period, needs to start early. They need to be made aware of what is facing them or what could face them.
The stat that Kim just said about the fourth grade dropout, I mean, the fourth grade literacy rate, and they use that to decide on what prisons to build, that particular statistic needs to be loud on everybody's Facebook page and told to anybody who's about to have a child. Say, look.
Yes. You know,
who
talked about
your
that.
Kids, if you don't get your kids some learning, they will prepare a place for jail for his
That's
ass.
Right. And I'll tell you, a book who someone who talked about that in one of his books was Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu in Countering a Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys. This is not a book that is recent. This, I think he wrote this book back in the 80s. Now, I remember that book as a child. So, you know, this is not something that is new or that we shouldn't, you know, that should have been explained and been being taught to our children a long time ago.
Right. Here, just for anecdotal purposes, I taught my little sister how to add when she was three. Okay? And I just one day I just did it out of the blue. My sister ended up being valedictorian of her school.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. But when you are in such a financial crisis all the time just to be able to live, I'm sure it would be very difficult to take the time to help your kid learn at the early age. You know what I mean? You're basically either you are fighting to have a job good enough to be able to pay for some child care and live, I don't know what the other option is.
Yeah, these things are definitely taken into consideration. I understand I grew up, you know, in the projects, come from a single household, you know, so I definitely understand, you know, that concept and where you're coming from with that, Travis, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, however,
my mom worked third shift as a respiratory therapist. I had my grandparents and aunts and uncles that, you know, to watch us sometimes. And she did all of that and you know, lucked up and got one of those dollar houses where it's an old beat-up house. And if you got good enough credit, you can get the credit to get the house fixed up. And then, boom, you got your house for a dollar. But that's like the thing waiting for Superman. I mean, how many magic, lucky opportunities are there? There needs to be there needs to be a better way to educate people. Computers, the internet, I mean, you can learn anything, anywhere. So everybody, like, what?
People have to get out of this victim mentality as well. A lot of us have it. A lot of us think that if something won't happen, or if, you know, if something doesn't happen and it won't, you know, if you keep predicting that for yourself, then of course that's what it's going to be. You know, the positive thinking needs to be a little more reinforced in our communities. You know, we can't hold on to historical baggage. We need to learn from it.
I mean, how many quote unquote ghetto type communities have computer centers where anybody can come use it for free? I mean, because
you still have, I don't know if they have the centers, but you do have, I know you have the public libraries, and also a lot, don't be fooled. It's like a lot of these people, and we've seen it in the ghettos growing up. You know, we've seen a lot of these people, a lot of our people, you know, they put emphasis on material items. You know, some people have the latest car, and they have computers, have the latest phones and stuff. It's just that their priorities are in the wrong places
in a lot of these times. What they use it for.
Right,
all
absolutely.
Right,
they're not
learn,
using it to educate their children or educate themselves.
You're right.
Exactly.
If you want to learn anything.
It's true. You'll see some ramshackle, busted-up houses in the ghetto with a brand-new car outside on rims.
Yeah.
And, There is some type of money being spent. There is money even in poor people's lives. But But when you talk about priority, I think like poor people, there was a time when I felt like I spent like that, like didn't care for your own home, didn't care for what was secret and private to you. The only thing that you spent money on was outward appearance things, clothes, your car, because you felt like, why should I live small? Why should I have to walk around the world as a poor person and people see me as a poor person? Why should I have to take 5-10 years to build up savings and credit to really live like this? They don't want to wait. You know, it becomes like, why should I? These other people don't have to wait. They really have a Mercedes, and they can afford it. So people want the Mercedes even though they can't afford it, and even though their house is falling apart. There's a sense of like that they're punishing themselves. Like, what? I'm born poor, so what?
Right, and then who does the responsibility fall on then? You know, you can't blame the establishment. You can't totally blame the establishment on that just because you didn't want to wait to save up your money, but you wanted to have a car or something nice before you had something of tangible value that you could use to move you up out of this neighborhood.
But isn't that just like a front thing? Isn't that just a fronting thing, like where you're broke at home, but I don't seem broke outside?
Oh, definitely. You know, definitely.
Yeah. Right?
And at what point do we get past that mentality of that we have to front or that we have to put up this appearance that we have when we really don't? At what point do we show our children that, you know, the material value of things, they have to come with time? And they have to come with...
But no, in addition to that, we also have to teach our children how to appreciate each other and not put each other down, because that's one of the things that I see quite often with some of the ad hominem attacks that I see within the community. Oh, well, look at how you're dressed, or, oh, look at what you're driving. It really shouldn't matter. It really shouldn't matter. There will always be people who are, you know, more advantaged than other people, and that's fine. That happens. But, again, going back to, you know, what you were stating earlier, Mandy, about people just, you know, there are things they need to learn how to save. They need to learn how to invest, maybe invest back into their communities, because I'm tired of hearing people complain about other cultures coming into their communities and opening businesses, but yet, you know, they're not trying to put their money together collectively and possibly doing something like putting together or creating a holding company and then establishing smaller businesses in their areas. The only people that really have a majority of the money in most of these economically and educationally disadvantaged communities are the churches. And those are the same people pimping them out and purposely keeping them poor.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was wondering if we were going to get to jumping in religion's ass.
Oh, yeah, because even going back to the Davis case, the sister said they've been going to church all their lives, and, of course, everybody keeps praying. I even heard Big Boy on TV the night of the execution when it was delayed saying that was God. I mean, when does this stop?
I know. Hey, what did Robert Ingersoll said that the hands that help are 10,000 times better than the lips that pray.
Yes.
One of the best things that my dad ever said to me, and this is what parents don't give their children, they, you know, making that break from generational to generational, you know, generational poverty. Somewhere an adult needs to just break the cycle. And my dad, being an immigrant, right, coming here, learn the language, all that, didn't have this American sort of sense of entitlement. And so here I was. Now, we worked for, it was a family business, a construction, and me and my older brother, you know, we worked just for free with him, like most family businesses. So there wasn't a lot of money, 8 kids, right? And sometimes I would want money to go to the mall and would say, hey, you know, dad, I mean, like $5. Now, this is in the early 80s. So $5 wasn't nothing. You know, movies were maybe $1 or $2. And so, you know, he'd go, yeah, there's no money right now. I'm like, but I worked for it. You know, this is BS. You know, not, you know, you're just complaining because you're like 13 or 14. And I said, but everybody's going to the mall. Everybody has money to go to the mall. Like, you ain't even got $5, right?
Right.
And my dad said, hey, you ain't one of them. You're not one of those people. Stop trying to chase down their world, motherfucker.
You're not a boss kid. Mm-hmm.
They have money. Their parents have money, and they've had money. They ain't working for shit. We're working over here. Like, you ain't none of them. Stop, man. What are you asking for? This is your life over here. We got 8 kids, right, and a family business. So get into it, motherfucker.
Right. And, you know, one thing I will say is that I do think that if it's available, I do think that there needs to be a balance of being able to enjoy what you work for as opposed to, you know, making it seem like you just always have to work, work, work. Because I think what's happened with a lot of, and I mean not just in the black community, but in a lot of communities, period, is that, you know, people, a lot of these, a lot of the older, you know, the older generations, they worked and they saved so much for their children, but then somehow the value of work got lost and the children just spent. And I think there does need to be a balance of being able to enjoy some of what you work for. Because if you're just working for it and you don't get to enjoy it, that can kill you just as fast as you spending it all and not having it.
Yeah, and that's how we kind of were. Everybody would, like, when there's a barbecue, we all party. When there's a birthday, we all party. But when you're complaining about yourself, that never got much ear time from my parents, like trying to act like I need this or I need,
right.
You know, and nowadays, mm-hmm. Recognize each individual child almost too much. You know, my girlfriend, her family has got, everybody has their own special stomach. And I can't eat this, and I can't eat these spices, I can't eat meat, I can't eat cheese. And she said everyone would get their own little meal every day, like some little twist. What was, I go, what? That's genetics aren't like that. Like, you know, my mom said, here's spaghetti, some bread, and some salad. Everybody, 8 kids, not a peanut allergy, not a lactose, glucose, nothing. That's what we had to eat, and that's what we all appreciated and ate.
Right.
Now, every child, you see three, you got three, people got 3 kids, they got 3 cupboards. For those MFs.
You know what? I admit that. I am guilty of that at times. I will admit to that.
Well, we're going to bring area code 601 into the conversation. 601, are you there?
I'm here. How are you guys today?
Okay.
Great.
Good. And your name is?
This is Eric, Kim.
Oh, hey, Eric.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Mandisa. Hi, Travis. Hi, Tana.
Hello.
So,
hello.
Yeah. Glad to be on. I was listening to the show, but listening to you guys, one of the things that I was, when I was actually posting Kim on your page earlier, is the same thing that I'm about to say now. People need to be educated. I'm agreeing totally with what you're saying. People should start educating one another. Stop waiting for the talking heads on television, the politicians to say this is what we need to do, this is how we need to do it. People need to start talking amongst themselves within the community and actually do something for themselves as opposed to waiting for an action to take place. And that's our biggest problem, like you said.
Agreed.
Apathetic. We sit back,
agreed.
We wait for something to happen. We wait for a Cornel West, a Al Sharpton, Eric Michael Dyson to say something, especially in the black community. We wait for those people to lead us instead of saying, you know what, this is not something that I want to tolerate anymore. I need to be able to get up and talk to my neighbor and say, we need to do something about our community, as opposed to waiting for that person on television to say, you know, this is an injustice. We need to stand up for it.
I absolutely agree with you, Eric. And one thing that concerns me, or another thing that concerns me, is this collective, you know, there seems to be this notion of a collective group thing, that all of us as black people or people in general need to agree on one solution.
because even going back to the whole apathy versus action, you know, someone may consider educating children, you know, apathy, but it is actually action. You know, it doesn't mean that you're being lazy, doesn't mean that you're being indifferent, but someone's definition of what would be considered apathetic could be different from what someone, you know, what one person's definition could be different from what someone else's would be. And where do we get, you know, where does the objectivity come in with that? You know, I'm concerned that, you know, we're not being objective as to the solutions that we're taking, that some feel like it's not enough, some may feel like it's too much, and I'm just wondering where we get that middle ground, you know, as
exactly.
to be able to look at what it is that, and that there's no one wrong way to go about it.
Right, exactly, and I agree with Eric, we need to be proactive as opposed to reactive, and that's another, you know, issue that I have in regards to just some of these cases and some of the emotional triggers that I see with, you know, our community regarding, you know, certain situations. Why is it that they wait for, you know, Sharpton and Jackson and Dyson, so on and so forth? What people have failed to realize is that we are the leaders. We are the change that we've been looking for.
Instead
of sitting back and waiting on others to do it, why don't we just go out there and do it ourselves? That's the reason why I say we have to be a solutions-based movement. It's time to stop talking and it's time to start doing.
Right.
If I could, really quick, another part that you talked about as far as dealing with education and educating our children, that's the first step that we need to be looking at. Believe it or not, and you guys talked about how they, with the prison systems, how they do the surveys, and they are actually tracking students. Students automatically are tracked once they go into the public school system. They
yes,
start
that is
the
true.
Process out all as soon as they get into the school system. Once they test you, they know exactly where you are. They build your class curriculum around your test scores, and that's why you see a lot of people trying to get into the charter system and trying to get into some of the public schools because of the fact that your children are tracked, because of the fact that your life is kind of dictated in so many ways as far as the classes that you're put into and how you're, whether or not you're determined whether you're going to be a college student, and the fact that you have prisons that are now corporations. You have Wackenhut and a few other people that trade on the public market. They're trading, basically trading human souls for a profit. And they go to small towns where there's a small population. They build these large prisons. And I don't know if some of you listened to my show. It was, I had Umar Johnson on, who talked about the population increase. They get funding. These small towns get funding based on the number of population that they have. And when you have hundreds of thousands of prisoners, or, you know, a couple of thousand prisoners in your town, you increase your population, which means you're able to increase the funding that flows into that community. So this is a general, you know, it generates funds going into those towns. So this is a very profitable business.
Mm-hmm.
Going a step back, when we talked to you guys, we're talking about snitches. If you've ever worked inside the law enforcement side, on the law enforcement side, if you ever had the opportunity to listen to someone, that crap about snitches get stitches, that's good, a good theory on the streets. But if you, I've sat in and as a counselor in a detention center, when you start talking about adding time to a sentence or giving someone giving actual points where they actually may have to serve time, that snitches get stitches stuff gets thrown right out the window. They will tell about you. They will tell about your mom, your dad,
I'm sure.
and your cousin. If they can get 2 seconds off their sentence. So, you know, that's part of what we do. We need to pull our children back from the media, because a lot of this crap is what you see in the media. You have these commercial hip-hop rappers who are talking about don't snitch, the po-po this and the po-po that, and we've bought into that mentality. While there are studies that also show that there are some police officers with the mentality that as long as they have the badge, they do take on a God complex. And it does affect our community because most of those police officers don't live in our community. So there's that dual, you know, where those two factions that are kind of rubbing against each other, and we need to start working together and building our community, again, based on communication with one another.
Right.
I am definitely a proponent of the law enforcement that you see monitoring and in your neighborhood. I believe that those particular law enforcement officers should live in that community. I believe that. I believe that the teachers that teach at the local schools, they should live in that community. I really do believe, because then they will have a better understanding of the pulse of that particular community.
Well, you know, I'm going to kind of disagree a little bit there, because I mean, I do think that, yes, it is important for them to know the community, know the children, know the parents. However, relegating them to living there, you know, is kind of like limiting, you know, basically limiting your rights, so to speak. I think that people should be able to live wherever they want. However, it is important for them to know and be concerned and care about the communities in which they work as well.
True.
So, I mean, again, I slightly differ on that to an extent,
right,
because then that means that, okay, well, you know, should they have to just move, let's say, for example, if they decide to leave that community, you know, I mean, should they just have to pick up and move wherever they go? I mean, I don't think that's, I mean, just looking at it in theory, too, you know.
Right. No, I understand perfectly, but here in the city of Chicago, in order for you to work for the city of Chicago, you must live in Chicago proper.
Right. Okay. Right.
Well, I feel that to a certain extent, yeah, I believe that they should live in the communities, or they should select teachers that live in the communities. But again, it should be multicultural, it should be very diverse, and it should just be a culmination of, you know, different socioeconomic levels. So that way, again, you're teaching people, and hopefully with some of the people, again, on the lower rung of the socioeconomic ladder, maybe they'll learn some things from the people who have gone out and educated themselves and have careers, and maybe that will present opportunities for them for, like, externships, internships, mentorship programs. You know, I'm looking at, you know, a bigger picture in all of that, but I believe that if people lived in the community, they would care more about the students because they would see them a little bit more often, and that's not taking away their particular personal lives or their privacy or anything like that. But I really do believe that the people that live in the community, or if they lived in the community, they would have more of a rapport, not only with the people in the community, but it will foster a better type of relationship, you know, with their students and not only with themselves as well, because they'll understand where these kids are coming from. Because if these kids, if the only thing they're seeing all day are, you know, drug addicts running around, the dope boys on the corner, if their parents, you know, happen to be, you know, addicts of some sort, whether it's drugs or alcohol, and these kids don't even know where their next meal is coming from, the main reason why they attend school is so that they can eat, and they're trying to learn something in between. If the teachers kind of knew and understood what was happening, I just believe that it would be a better relationship.
Yeah, that is true.
So, I don't know. It's just, you know, a lot of different, funny to move the law. Basically, it's just, I just believe that we need to create better type of local community relationships. And going back to what we were talking about earlier regarding the no snitch rule, yeah, all of that, again, we need to, like they say, laugh at it. Let them see how ridiculous it is for them to walk around saying no snitch and not cooperating with the police, not cooperating with the investigators coming around trying to solve a problem in your neighborhood. This is where you live. You complain about the crime, you complain about the trash, you complain about all of these different things, yet many don't want to get out there and work towards a solution. I just feel that it's self-defeating.
Yes, I do. I do as well.
Hello?
Hey. Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Oh, I was going to say, a lot of it is also focuses on, you talked about economics too. We don't know anything, well, I won't say we don't know, but there's a large majority of people who don't understand what it means to invest in your community and in learning how to invest in yourself. If you are by far as the U.S. is concerned, I would just stick with the U.S. and not the global market, but by the U.S. standards, African Americans are the largest buying power. But like you said before, we don't know what it means to invest. We'll invest in a car which depreciates as soon as you drive it off the lot, but don't understand what it means to invest in a home which appreciates over time. We don't understand what it means to take our money and put it into investments, learning about investments. A lot of us are just like, I'll take whatever you give me, or I'll spend. We live paycheck to paycheck. And the sad thing about it is, when I talk to young people about this, I explain to them, and a lot of them are shocked to realize that most people are two paychecks away from being poor or being homeless. They don't really understand that if you're not really following the advice of some of the economists, pick one, Susie Orman or Ali Vesey, whoever you want to pick, and they're talking about taking a percentage of your paycheck, putting it away, learning how to pay yourself in the sense that you're taking this money and putting it away for the long term. Right now, we live in that, we buy into the, I want it right now, I got to have it right now, as opposed to learning to save. And it's really, it kills us as a community. We're not really trying to figure out how to invest and how to get our money, whereas, like you said before, a business comes into our community, they take over, their dollar is going back to their community and circulates. The black dollar only circulates once in its community, one time.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. No, I agree with you wholeheartedly there. And, again, it's incumbent and imperative on our behalf to get out there and try to educate the people. But, again, it's a cultural thing because I just see so many people out here trying to drive the best car, trying to wear the best clothes, trying to present this image. And they're trying to present it to people who pretty much just don't care. And they're trying to outdo each other. And for what? What reason? What reason? The minute you buy that outfit, the minute you buy that car, it's lost half its value. As a matter of fact, the outfit has no value whatsoever. It's only as expensive as it is because they know that these people will go out and buy it. If there wasn't such a high demand for it, the prices would come down. It's basic microeconomics, supply and demand. And it's worthless. It's worthless crap. And I try to explain to some of these young people that means nothing. If you were to lose your job, your financial means of, livelihood, tomorrow, do you have enough money in savings to kind of coast your way through for the next 6 to 12 months? Are you saving money? Are you putting money away? Do you have a plan B? So, someone moves your cheese, which is a good book. If someone moves your cheese, what are you going to do? How are you going to recover? Again, do you have a plan B? And in a lot of cases, they don't even have a plan A, let alone a plan B. And they're flying by the seat of their pants and then can't understand why everything goes, just south. Everything goes sour in their particular situation. But, again, a lot of that is perfect because I've never understood it. Some of the people going back to the church thing here, I've gone to church, seen people in their Sunday's best, getting their little Cadillac in their bin and drive off, and then you go to their house, and all they have in the refrigerator is bologna and peanut butter because that's all they can afford to eat. But yet they make sure they put their 10% plus extra in the collection plate, and in addition to that, they volunteer for all of these services or all of these little groups in the church when, in all actuality, what they're volunteering for, the pastor should be paying them. He's getting paid. So not only is just it's absolutely amazing, but it's a perpetual cycle of, for lack of better words, fuckery. You know, and I just, I don't understand it. And I've been telling people to time to basically reevaluate the situation. I've been telling them that for years. But I've been branded as a troublemaker because I'm asking people to use their logic and their critical thinking skills and to open their eyes and not allow these people to take advantage of them. So what do you do? What do you do?
Kim, that what you just said is the stereotypical thing that kid gets us all the time, in the sense that when you start opening your mouth, you're labeled a troublemaker. Think about it in a historical sense for those that are listening. Think about those who have started out saying things and were active in the community. They were called troublemakers. They were called the rabble rousers, whatever you want to put the label on. But basically, you demonize the people that require you to think outside the norm, so that people will say, "Well, I don't want to listen to Kim because Kim, you know, Kim is that troublemaker from down the way, and you know, every time she comes in, trouble gets started, and we can't, you know, nothing gets done around her." And you always have that mentality, so that mentality festers when all you're doing is putting out information for people to really see and think about. And that's what's killing us, is the fact that nobody's really sitting down and talking. And when you have the opportunity, you have a platform to speak on these issues, people are afraid and they sit back and they don't want to say anything, but they know it's true. So, you know, you have to get past that whole, you know, hopefully people will learn to get past the labeling that other people put on you.
Right.
That's put out there.
Exactly. That's the truth. And, you know, again, when you're out there and you're encouraging people, again, to utilize critical thinking skills, to use logic in their daily lives, you're not creating trouble for those people. You're creating trouble for the people who are manipulating and exploiting them.
Yeah.
Well, we have a call from 425 on the line. 425, you are now on the air.
Hi, Kim. This is John. Hey, I know what you mean about troublemaker. I've been labeled troublemaker pretty much most of my life. You know, just today, I was just walking through the store just to get a soda or something. And I passed by this one place that has a lot of meetings for like black centric people and organizations. And there was these Muslim dudes who came by me, who walked by, and one came up to me. I knew one of them, and the one came who didn't know me and said, "Hey, we're looking for some guests to come up to speak. Receive the message of Minister Farrakhan." And before I could really respond, I think I said something like, "Nah, I'm not interested." You know, the guy who knew me said, don't talk to him. Don't talk to him." And I told him, "Right, I'm an atheist, homie." You know what I'm saying? And the other guy who I knew, we used to play chess together. I used to visit his shop, spend money in it. Money at a shop a little bit, buy some incense and whatnot. And he sort of started hating on me because on Facebook I, you know, put a little information about Farrakhan and about, you know, the Nation of Islam. And, you know, he emailed me something and said, "I wish you'd stop attacking my leader," and all that. And I said, "Well, I didn't attack your leader. This is exactly what your leader said." As a matter of fact, it was a quote that Farrakhan had said. Farrakhan said, what's the use of making people holy and dumb at the same time?" That's what he said.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But he thought it was an attack on Farrakhan. He thought I made it up, you know. But in truth, Farrakhan himself said this, you know. So I just posted it. And I posted, like, some other stuff about, you know, the history of Farrakhan, the history of Malcolm X, the history of their teacher, Elijah Muhammad, his history with his teacher, Wallace Farrard or Wallace Ford. And people don't like it because they hate to realize that, you know, that the dude was a white man. You know, he started the whole religion. You know, they try to say he was a god in the flesh and all this kind of stuff. But they label me a troublemaker. But, you know, so what? I sort of like it. because I know I'm getting stuff done. If everybody likes you and everybody loves you and everybody thinks you're cool, in my opinion, you're really not doing anything.
Exactly. They're just part of the group, and that's what they want. They want clones. They want people to basically conform to their particular ideas, their particular doctrines, their particular what have you. And those of us who refuse to conform and aren't necessarily subjected to acculturation and inculturation, though we are the ones that they focus on in a negative fashion, labeling us as troublemakers. But then ironically, in a few cases in which the people labeled me troublemaker or what have you, several years later, they came back and told me that I was right. But they were the loudest people out there against me initially. And I just find it ironic because I see a lot of, again, church folks now, I see them rallying against the church, and they're basically, back in the day when I was still involved in religion, I was teaching against tithing and several other things, and I was called crazy. Now, some of those same people, now I see them using literature and information that I supplied them. Now, they're using that to undergird their arguments, which I find interesting, but again, in some cases, it's a matter of experience. We have to go through different things. We have to go and do the research on their own, which is fine, and I encourage that. Anything that any of us say, I encourage people to go out and do the research on it because I don't want anyone to take anything I say necessarily at face value. I want you to do the research because if you research what I say, you're going to research what other people say as well. And that's very, very important because they will learn that people will lie to them with a smile on their face and a knife in their back.
Hmm.
So true. All day long, and in the name of indoctrination, they're going to continue to do it, thinking that they're on the side of the righteous, that they have some divine spirit that invokes them the right to step on your humanity, which is crazy. But I think you put it on one of your Facebook's posts about how they think that people like us are crazy, but they believe in a book of fairy tales and wizards and people walking on water and whatnot. I'm paraphrasing it, but, I think you get the gist of what I mean.
That was a P.Z. Myers quote, and he was talking about how, religious people, they want to brand us as insane when they're believing in a book, with sticks turning into snakes, people walking on water, some wizards, warlocks, and sundry, and yet we're the ones that's crazy. And it's really interesting. Go ahead, hon.
No, I was just backing up what you said that it happens perpetually, every day, every minute, every week, every hour, and it's dragging down the humanity of the world. Because if we don't get to this next level of technology, we're going to be stuck. We're going to continuously be stuck in the Stone Age, And I just wish that, especially us brothers and sisters, would just get out of this religious indoctrination, man, and get into this reality. I mean, you spend all this time in churches, and church. I wish people would spend more time in colleges than they would in these churches. They're getting more
stuff. Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Because the churches, what do you do? All you do is study mythology, which has nothing to do with your life. Nothing.
Exactly.
You can go to college and you can get paid to go to college. You're not going to be paid to go to church unless you continue the lies of the reverend or the priest or whoever is invoking the indoctrination. And it's a vicious cycle, Most of the church people are poor. Most of the church people put their last dollars into a crazy tax in which the people they give it to are not being taxed. I mean, that's crazy. Nothing is done for them. I mean, well, sometimes they pick and they choose who they're going to help, who they're going to assist for housing, who they're going to put clothes on. You know what I'm saying? And it doesn't make any sense for you to dumb your keep dumb, to pay to dumb yourself down. I just don't understand it.
Exactly. Oh, and they are the first ones to laugh when we present Greek, you know, Greek mythology to them or any type of mythology. And they'll laugh at those people and say, how could they believe that? That was so stupid. And then we turn around and say, you believe the same thing. Because when we do a comparative analysis of a lot of the mythology of old and what they're believing and teaching in the Bible is nothing but badly plagiarized mythology. That's all it is. And when you point that out, and especially when you start pointing out people like Mithras and, you know, a lot of these other characters from mythology that were born on the 25th of December that had 12 disciples, and you just see the correlation between that and the Bible, and you point that out to people, and they say, well, they make excuses. They make excuses for it, and they tell you, well, no, they stole that from the Bible. No, this was written before the Bible was even conceived. So how is that?
Exactly.
And that's exactly, you know, what's happening there. And you point it out and you try to help them. But, you know, again, we've kind of gotten a little bit off topic, but, you know, using that, just going back into the religious, you know, the religion of this here, the people that were praying for Troy Davis and these other people who they felt were wrongfully convicted, where is your God? Where is he? Because he's gone. And I believe someone on one on their Facebook page, someone had posted this, that someone had posted how somebody had claimed that they had spoken to God and God said that Troy's life would be spared. And they said that that person hasn't posted since. Where is that person? Why don't you have anything to say now? You know, if your God is all-powerful, you know, omnipotent, as they claim, then why couldn't he stop that? And why was Troy found guilty in the first place? Why were his appeals denied? Why? Where is your God? If he's all-powerful and all-knowing, why did he allow that to happen?
Well, religious people play both sides of the fence. If Troy would have been saved, they would have said it was because of Jesus or because of Jehovah or whatever. But now that he's dead, now they're going to say it's God's will and it's a great overall plan for some kind of destiny. So they play people, play on both sides of the fence. You're not going to get no kind of honest doctrine with religious folks. You're just not going to get it. And this is how they've been able to use these key brainwash words like faith to deceive people to make that leap into stupidity. You know, I think I seen one time it was on a school about somebody had wrote that faith is like taking a step. Is like taking a step on some stairs or something when you don't see the whole staircase. Well, that's a lie. Faith is more like you taking a step.
You walking blindfolded on that staircase.
Yeah.
And you're not smelling the fire that's at the top or at the bottom.
Exactly.
That's what faith is.
I mean, this is how they try to deceive people. This is the deception. This is the, man, I mean, I can't. And it reveals itself, manifests itself so many times, perpetually throughout history, over and over and over again. And still, you have in the 90% of people that believe. But now, you know, a lot of people are not believing. Even the Christian scientists are now saying, "Man, I don't even think we can't keep passing this through Jesus myth along because there's no proof. There's nothing." I mean, you know, they're even coming out with stuff, man, like, look, man, there's no science behind any of this doctrine that we're putting out, man. We need to modernize it. And I put that, you know, I reposted that, and then a friend of mine came back and said, well, those guys aren't real Christians. And I said, well, how do you know that they're not real Christians? What's the difference? He said, well, real Christians, what did she say? She said something like, real Christians, oh, I forgot what she said. But anyway, when they step out of the normal doctrine, all of a sudden now they alienate them. Because if you don't go exactly with what's in the Bible, which is in the populace of the Bible, not what's truly in the Bible, because if it's everything in the Bible, then a lot more people have got to be put to death, a lot more women have to be stoned and defecated on and all this kind of stuff. But the populace of the popular opinion of the Bible is what really counts, what's politically correct for the time. And it's just crazy. It's really crazy. But getting back to Troy Davis, I just think that, you know, Troy Davis didn't have the complexion for the connection, just like I tell a lot of people. If you got seven jurors that recanted their statements, normally for a white person, that'd be all good. You're not gonna execute them on that. But being that you got a black life and then you got the police, whose life is way more valuable than an American citizen, let alone a black American citizen. I mean, you just can't win that. You're going to always have these people out there that's going to play, even us black people, that play the sympathy card of, well, what about the victim's family? What about that? Wait a minute, man. This dude took an oath to defend the community. He carried a gun everywhere. He or she carried a gun everywhere in the neighborhood. Let me carry a gun everywhere in the neighborhood. I think my life is going to be pretty safe. You know what I'm saying? And they're backed by a bunch of people carrying guns. The biggest gang in the country is law enforcement. Period. They're the biggest gang. So, I don't see. They put people away for life sometimes, let alone kill them. What about their families? What about the families of the people that they sent away for 10, 20, 30 years? What about the people that they killed on the streets? What about their families? They don't count.
But they do, John. And I'm just going to interrupt you here for a little bit. Yes, those factors absolutely do come into play. You are right about that. However, I still think that we are being careless and not being subjective in looking at these cases on an individual basis. I just don't think that this one warrants the whole racial issue because, yes, we have seven witnesses that recanted their testimony. However, the two witnesses that were key to this trial did not. And these things are not being looked at on the basis. We're just looking at the historical races, a basis of race. And we really do have to start looking past that. Or beyond that.
I disagree with that because race is a key factor. I mean, for one, I would love for it not to be a key factor in cases like this, but you know.
But and then how do you account for the fact that the majority of the jury was black? The majority
well,
of the jury was predominantly black in this case.
Right. How I account for it is because the majority of black people are assimilated. You know, they'll go with whatever a lot of white folks say. Look at Adam West.
Yes, go ahead.
Especially in Atlanta, Georgia, come on. Are you kidding me?
Well, you got to also understand that the population, as far as what they were saying, as far as in the state of Georgia, the black male represents 15% of the state of Georgia, 48% of the prison population. Mandisa was on a point when she was saying, as far as the evidence, there was, when you talk about the nine witnesses, that eyewitnesses who testified, seven recanted, the eighth one was supposedly the was considered one of the prime suspects in the murder, and is still thought to be the man person, the person that shot, actually shot, committed the murder. The ninth witness is supposedly one that said he saw the accident or the murder place was at like 125 yards away, and it was dark. And they were saying that there was no way that this person could have really made out any physical characteristics. The other part to that was that they were taken to the crime scene as witnesses in a group, which is supposed to be, that's one of, like, a no-no for any lawyer that's trying a case that knows. They were taken to the crime scene and told, okay, well, this is where you were, you said you were, this is, they basically made them reenact it and told them this is what you said you saw and kind of directed them in what they were supposed to have seen. So that those are the factors. The other factor being the point of the ballistics test. It was a faulty ballistics test. And even one of the jurors pointed out and said, had they known about some of this information, they would not have voted him guilty. And so in that respect, and one of the things that I do agree with you, Mandisa, in the sense that taking the fact that his family, this man lost his life, his family wants to find closure. That's the biggest thing that they're looking for is closure. You can't discount that. I think that as an African-American male, I look at the fact that disproportionately we are constantly put in jail for longer sentences. We're put on death row.
I won't disagree there. Absolutely.
That's where a lot of it goes to. And even as of last week, I was looking at reading the case about this young black male who was put on death row. He was like the youngest person. He was a little kid. So you have all of this.
A 14-year-old boy.
Yeah. That all of these things factor into it, and this is kind of what plays into the psyche of black people when it comes to putting when you talk about a Troy Davis. Because consider this, Troy Davis has been up for execution and had it delayed four times prior to the actual happening.
Oh, yeah, we're aware of that.
Yeah.
we're definitely aware of that.
Yeah, and a lot of people are asking, and I heard it early on the show, someone was saying, where was all the support before then? There was support before then, but it was sensationalized by the media, and it garnered more support. But prior to that, you've had people across the globe who were saying that there's something needs to be done about this. So, you know, there are a lot of factors that go into considering, you know, how this all played out.
Going back to the timeline, just this year alone, he filed a new appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. In March, it was rejected, and basically September 7th of this year is when they set the fourth execution date, and that seemed to be about the time when everyone basically started jumping on the bandwagon for this particular case. But yet again, this case has been, this issue has been going on since 1989. He was initially charged with this crime in 1989, August of 1989. He's had four appeals. And while it has had some cases, you're right, the media sensationalized this case, which brought him even more support. I guess my question is that, again, where do we go from here? Because, see, Troy is gone. There's nothing we can do about that except continue to examine this case, because there have been people who have been exonerated posthumously. So it could be possible in this case in which they'll find him not guilty in all actuality, but again, we have other Troy Davises out there that are in the penal system that may or may not be guilty, that may have, you know, tainted evidence, that may have been railroaded into what, you know, to their situation. So what do we do from here? How do we galvanize the community to help those people? And in some cases, some of these people are truly guilty. So, again, we have to be careful about not
not lumping up all of them in the same category. I mean, we must obtain our objectivity. Sorry not to cut you off, Kim, but I just wanted to kind of expound upon that. You know, at this point, you know, yes, we are all aware of the historical ramifications of the injustices committed against us. But I think that what our ancestors fought and died for, one of the things that they fought and died for, was the ability for us to be able to maintain this objectivity and to educate ourselves on the issues and make informed opinions about them, whether we agree or not.
I'm sort of lost at the objectivity argument. I mean, it's almost like, to me, I might be misinterpreting what you're saying, but it's almost like you're saying, you know, people with an opinion about police brutality and about racism are not being objective. Is that what you're
saying? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. There are still cases that need to be looked at objectively and subjectively, that we should not be calling every case a police brutality case just because there is a black defendant involved. What I'm saying is that the details and the evidence.
Who is doing that? We're only talking about one particular case, in the case of Troy Davis.
Right, in the case of Troy Davis, people are creating, they're crying race foul without looking at all of the details.
Okay, so you don't believe that race played any factor in this?
Not in this case, I do not.
Okay, well, I mean, I think you're trying to be more politically correct instead of.
I have to disagree with you there. If I was trying to be politically correct, I would have said that he was automatically innocent and that he should have been set free.
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. Now you're putting extra extensions to what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, in this particular case, you're trying to blot out racism as if it plays no factor. There's been other white inmates that have been charged with way lesser evidence and got off.
But that now, how does that factor into the Troy Davis case? Now, I'm just asking now, how does that fit into this particular case? That's what I'm asking now.
Because if you have two individuals with a similar crime, and you have two different results, I mean, and the only difference between them is their race. Hello.
But again,
it's not only just their race, but it also goes back to their attorneys, because again, you know, Travis and Tana made a good point earlier. In many cases, it's not so much about race; it's about your socioeconomic standing. And if you happen to be poor, then in many cases you have a public defender or a public pretender. And in many cases they are so overwhelmed and inundated with work that they do not necessarily take out the proper time or have the proper tools available to them to fully research particular cases and case law and precedents so that they can present a good case. That's why they have many of these people plead to lesser charges, because they just want to clear the case, get it off their table, and move on to the next case. But in the case of Troy, he had seven jurors that were African American or black on the jury. And I understand where you're coming from, John, but in this case, I don't necessarily believe that it's a case of race. I really believe that, you know, he had incompetent attorneys. I'll just put it out there. I believe he had incompetent attorneys. He had four appeals. He had four separate chances besides his initial trial to appeal his case, to prove his innocence, to prove that the evidence had been tampered with, manipulated, and they could not prove their case.
Okay, so what you're saying is you have seven witnesses as compared to two, and that holds no standing. You have two of the witnesses which have questionable testimony, and you're
mm-hmm.
saying because of a possible economic difference, that it's more than that than it is when they've had since 1989 to look at the case? I don't understand that. I mean, can you guys help me with that?
I understand. He should have been granted a new trial. I agree. He should have been granted a new trial.
We find no other circumstances except for maybe two, which is race and economic class, one of the two. But how do we just wipe out race when you have seven jurors in Atlanta, Georgia? Let's recognize the place that they're at and the mentality of the black folks down in Atlanta, Georgia, who, if a policeman says anything, even within our race, they're going to point to the police and say he's right. They're going to point to the prosecutor and say he's right. This is the mentality of a lot of black folks.
Again, you know, we don't know for sure because, again, we weren't there, right? We cannot claim to know exactly what is in everyone's mind or every black person's mind there. We have to, I've spoken with someone who is from that area and who grew up at the time of this case and around the circumstances. Troy Davis did not have the best of reputations. He did not. And whether or not that plays a factor into his trial or what have you, you know, you cannot, there are certain things you just cannot discount in this particular case. You can't do it.
Well,
and
I don't,
everything
again,
that, everything
again,
Kim said.
Again, you're, again, we're not being clear. First of all, I'm not claiming to know exactly what happened. I'm not assuming all that. I'm not like, but whether he had a reputation or not, let's just take it as far as a female's point of view. If a female comes 4 a.m. in the morning, dressed with short skirt and everything, and out at 4 a.m. in the morning, and she winds up getting raped, the circumstance that she put herself in, is that an excuse for rape?
No one is saying that. What you're doing is assuming.
When you're in a justice system and you work in this type of system, you can't assume. And even though, you know, we may agree that, yeah, there may be some racism, and racism does play a part in the justice system and how it goes, but when I say that there's no evidence of racism in this particular case, what you have to do is sort of prove someone's mindset. Unless you can prove somehow that someone discriminated against him unjustly, then therefore you cannot conclude that racism played a part in this case. We might think that, and you might be right, but we can't assume that. There's no evidence of racism in it.
I go off of logic like this.
Right, it's really not logic.
If you eliminate all of the possible ways something happened, whatever left is probably what it is.
Right, that doesn't really add up. And if so, the justice system doesn't work like that. When you talk about beyond a reasonable doubt and proving things in court, that's why we don't go with type of thoughts like that. But you can't assume things.
Yes,
because,
you do.
Wait a minute.
Stop holding. Yes, you do. I mean, it's done in the justice. I don't know what court you've been in, but it's done every day in the American justice system. It was put forth back in the 80s when we were trying to fight racial profiling, because that's an assumption, and we're still doing it today. So I don't know what part of the court system that you've looked at.
No, but what I mean is when you make an assumption to prove guilt or innocence, or we're talking about beyond a reasonable doubt, you're talking about process of elimination, and when you removed all factors, and there's no other reason, this has got to be it. That's not the way it works. You can't just assume.
Yes, it is. Beyond reasonable doubt.
My thing, man, is that, you know, there's a such thing here is not only what you say you did, what you say you didn't do, but what they can prove you did or didn't do. And if they can prove that you did or didn't do it, whether you did or not, that's your problem right there. You're screwed. I think that in the rural South, you know, I live down here in Macon, so there is some very racist areas down here. Troy Davis had the misfortune of being a miscreant who did find himself accused of killing a white cop. I'm not saying that race was a factor, but, you know, you can't kill cops and get away with it.
Yes, you can.
So,
you can do whatever you want to do. I mean, let's speak pragmatically.
I might want to finish my thought, right?
There's been plenty of people that can kill cops and just walked off from it. I mean, you know. Tupac shot a cop, I think it was in Atlanta, and walked. So, I mean, you know.
Okay, cool. I appreciate it. But, you know, what I'm saying is that, you know, this man had the misfortune. I have not been able to counter the evidence against him. And for whatever reason that is, he found himself in the hot seat. I didn't know about this until a few weeks ago. And I did see a lot of people who I do think did jump on the bandwagon, simply because they figured this was a black man versus this government type situation.
Right, right.
I don't think Troy was too picky about that. But at the same time, I never said he was innocent. I said that the evidence against him and the circumstances of his being convicted and being denied a new trial were murky. That in itself means that there's a small window opportunity that this guy may not have done the crime he's being executed for, even though he may have done something he shouldn't have did.
Right,
we should have given him a new trial at the very least. If he was proven guilty again, what else can we say about that? I mean, I didn't see what the need was. We have
that's
to
the problem
kill
with. That's the problem with eyewitness testimony, and when you talk about, you know, human flaws within the justice system, because we talk about the way we use it is beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't think the state might have proved their case when they didn't have any evidence against it. I know they talked about the shell casing, and then later on, I know y'all talked about that earlier, but I was gone, and how it might have been flawed. But when there's evidence against it, if you can't exactly prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it, he shouldn't have been convicted, and that was the problem. When you plot it,
right.
The Casey Anthony case, in this case, is, in my opinion, is totally different. But a lot of people were pissed off because she, not quote, got off. But that's the way the system works, is to protect the innocents. So when you cannot prove that they did it, you have to let them go. In this case, the same ideology applies to Troy Davis, but it didn't work in this situation, and that's when it failed. He should have been applied that same line of thinking. This was in 81. We didn't use eyewitness testimony now like we do now, and we see now that it's flawed. This is just one of the many problems that we see going on with the justice system, the DNA and everything. And you could have been, you know, had some racist white woman who applied and just said that black guy did it. But we can't prove that racism had a factor. A lot of different things played into it. So I agree, he should have had a fair trial, and it shouldn't have went that far.
Well, I mean, when you say the word should is a D word. I'm pretty sure nobody who's in this conversation right now would want their life to be terminated because of should or misfortune. Whether or not. I mean, it's easy for us to sit back and play backseat lawyer, backseat quarterback, and say, well, it was a misfortune of.
And this is the reason why we are trying to push for moving forward. What do we do now moving forward?
With that, I mean, you wouldn't look at it that way. You would look at all the factors which presented itself. And it's funny how we are doing a double standard as far as saying that, well, if we can't prove racism, you know, then we shouldn't even be brought up. Well, apparently,
that's right. That's exactly
in 1981.
You couldn't prove that. What's wrong with that statement?
In the case that you couldn't prove that Troy Davis murdered somebody, but yet still the case stuck.
Dude, what are you talking about? What happened to Troy Davis back then was wrong. There's no denying that. But if you can't prove, that's the whole point of
it. There is
denying
it because he was convicted.
This is the whole point of the way. Wow. Say that again.
There is a point of this. Some people can say, hey, man, the man was convicted in a court of law.
No. He wasn't right. It wasn't right. He was convicted.
Wait a minute. You said that there's no argument. I mean, you're playing both sides of the fence now, homie. I mean, can we get this right?
I don't think I am. What do you mean?
I hear you. If you're saying on one hand one hand, that there's that this man was unjust, that this man was not convicted on good evidence, but he was. In reality, he was. And you're saying that nobody can make that argument. Well, what about the jurors, the original jurors that made, that voted him guilty? All of them.
Right. Do you know the story about the jurors? I thought we already talked about this, how the jurors talked about how they were coerced into the arguments.
I understand,
no,
but that has
not
no,
the jurors.
That has no
the jurors never said
that.
That
has no relevance to what I'm saying. Some people can argue that, well, you're missing my point totally. Some people can argue because they made that decision, he's convicted. He's convicted.
Okay.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
I'm following you.
How can you say that everybody, that you're saying an absolute, in which in 1981 the man was convicted. So some people did believe that he was guilty at the time. That's all my argument is. So to go back and say that, hey, well, I think it's I think that everybody will agree that he wasn't guilty. Well, he would have been convicted in the first place since everybody agreed that he wasn't guilty. That's my whole point.
He shouldn't have been convicted. He should have been found not guilty.
Well, and that goes back to what I said about should.
Okay, and what about should? I don't understand.
He should have not been. Should is a very angry word. This should not have happened to me. He should not have died. I should not have been convicted.
Right.
I mean, should is not a reality. It's the possibility of a reality, which is the expectations in which you apply to your vision of the world and what you think should happen.
No. According to the law, he shouldn't have been.
Well,
something happened.
There
was a breakdown in the system. Something happened in the system, and it could have been racism. We don't know, but something happened in the system where it failed, and he shouldn't have been convicted according to the law.
Okay, well, what happened in the system? You tell me what happened in the system.
Hello?
Well, here it is that I'm it says a ballistics expert testified that the .38 caliber bullet that killed McPhail could have been fired from the same gun that wounded Cooper, who was the other guy that Davis was convicted of shooting. I think he lived. He said, though he admitted doubt about this. However, he stated that he was confident that the .38 casings found matched allegedly one of the that was one that was found near the scene of the crime. So basically what they're saying is the ballistics evidence was able to show that the casings at the officer shooting and the one at the other man shooting was more than likely a match, because we're forgetting that there were two people that were shot that night. So according to the law and according to that and the eyewitness testimony, they felt that was enough to convict him.
Okay. So.
So how can we say that the system is flawed based on that when the jury, who was made up of 7 blacks and 5 whites, how can we say that it was racist against him, though, given everything that was presented?
Two of the people on the board that were deciding whether or not he should be given clemency were black. I think it was two black men, two white men, and one white woman, from what I saw. So I don't know if it's racist. I don't believe it's racism myself. So,
well,
I mean,
as far as I'm concerned, if you have seven witnesses beat two witnesses, in my opinion. If 7 witnesses said that something happened different than the other two, and then in other cases. Where they don't even have as much evidence, and you have white defendants who get off from less than that, I think it's racism. That's my point.
But it's not.
See, I can't totally agree there, because once again, the two main witnesses did not recant. The two witnesses that were key to this case, two is more than enough. To raise that reasonable doubt, it's still
enough. For 7. Wait a minute, help me out here. Now you have to
again. The one witness who went to the police, and who fingered Davis. He was one of the witnesses. He did not recant. He did not recant his statement. So
okay,
that weighs.
What about the other 7? How does that beat 7 other people?
Well, again, now let's keep in mind that. All of the witnesses, I'm sorry, not to cut you off, Mario, not all of the witnesses totally recanted. their testimony. Some of them revised their testimony. Some recanted, some revised it. So it wasn't necessarily.
How many of them revised the testimony?
I think it was about four of them that revised and only three that recanted. So, again, it's enough.
Let's just say four. How does one beat four witnesses? If you had five people, and they said, well, and they give you directions to go to a certain place. Four of them gave you direction to go to this place, and one of them told you to go to this place. Which ones would you believe?
I would believe the one who gave you the right directions.
I don't think it's a matter of quantity.
Exactly. It's quality. It was the quality of the witness in the recantation.
Let's look at the quality of each witness. Are they all equal or are they not equal?
Apparently they weren't. And in the eyes of the legal system and those
that's
who reviewed the case, it was not enough
now
to reverse it.
No, you're guessing now. I can't go on.
I'm not guessing.
You're
I mean,
guessing.
The, we're not guessing because he wasn't denied. He wasn't granted a new trial. So that is fact that they felt that it wasn't enough. It is fact that they ruled that.
Yeah, but the rest of America doesn't agree with that. They just don't agree with that.
I don't get what we're arguing here. Are you arguing that he was innocent or that he should have never been convicted or that he shouldn't have been executed or what?
Are you asking me or her?
I'm asking you.
I'm arguing the fact about racism. I don't believe he should have been convicted, period. Now with seven witnesses against two.
Well, at the time that he was convicted, all nine witnesses were against him. Let's keep that in mind.
At the time is not now.
Well, again, now because he has been executed.
At the time is not now.
Because the judges and because whoever else was involved did not think that those seven witnesses were strong enough to grant a new trial, then this is where it went.
Okay,
this
well,
is
okay.
How we came to that outcome.
To grant a new trial, but they were strong enough back then to have a conviction. I don't understand. And also, what we failed to realize is that
once those witnesses recanted, then the Supreme Court sent it back for the evidence to be reviewed again. So they were given another chance. The defense was given another chance to be able to strengthen their case for a new trial. What we are forgetting that is they were given chances, like Kim said earlier. Those chances were given.
And plenty of court cases in the Supreme Court and beyond, that they give lawyers another chance to make their case. Not, most of the time they don't, actually, though. Only like about less than 10% do. And not to discuss all the factors of the case most of the time. That's even a less percent. So I don't think that's entirely true.
I think, you know, the burden right here that he had against him is that not only did he – once he was proven guilty, he had to prove that he was innocent. And if there's no way to prove that he was innocent, other than the fact that the case is murky, they felt like it wasn't worth reviewing again. And he did have, I mean, reading over the details of the case as far as I could, I'm not an expert on it, but he did have plenty of chances to prove this. But the point is, because we're sitting here, I mean, we're saying here on Facebook and on this show right here, is that there are so many different interpretations of what was presented and what we read, what we were shown, that idea alone probably merits a new trial. Because if we're debating this amongst each other, they had to be debating it.
Right. And what I'm just saying is that it's so easy to point the finger at the justice system or the pardons board and make it seem like they did not weigh this. And who's to say that they didn't? That's where we're coming from. Who's Who's to say that they didn't weigh this?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And there's a lot of evidence and a lot of information that they're privy to that's not necessarily privy to the public. So I believe mm-hmm. that there are some gaps. There are some things that are missing, and that information mm-hmm. will fully come to light. But basically, I do believe he should have been granted a new trial. You know, I stated that earlier. However, he wasn't, and it's a done deal now. You know, what do we do going forward? See, you know, we have to stop being stuck. I mean, whether it was right or wrong, it happened. We need to help other people out here who may be in the same situation. So what are you all proposing? You know, what are you proposing that we do for the future? You know, Amnesty International, Project Innocence, you have all of these law schools that have these different programs helping incarcerated people with DNA evidence and going over just, you know, evidence and information that, you know, that could have been tainted, manipulated, thrown out, withheld, that happened. So what are you going to do personally? I guess that's my question.
Right.
You know,
go ahead, Mario.
You know, I resent it. When I first found out about this, I didn't know much about it, and I thought, you know, maybe it's just another thing in which people get on a bandwagon about a black man. But as I started to read the case myself, while I didn't say that he was innocent, I said that there was doubt there. And I read the statistics before of people who had been exonerated from death row based on new evidence and DNA evidence right there. And it always bothered my mind, if we have let go even one person within the last year because it was proven that this guy didn't do it, how many people have we killed? So I think that as far as I can do from my living room in Macon, I'm not a Facebook investigator, unlike a lot of people. I can't investigate a case from my living room. So the best thing I feel I can do is as soon as I see an article, post it or talk about it, and try to get somebody else to look at this, you know, because I've always done that. You know, I've always posted something about child prostitution or something like that, and sometimes it goes unnoticed. Like it bothered me that I posted about the white guy who was beaten to death by the cops, and I barely saw any black person reposting that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But as soon as it became a black man, it appeared all over Facebook. I don't like that. I don't like that. And, you know what I'm saying? Life in general is important to me, and I'd do the same thing if it was another guy. And the fact that I saw so many white people out there standing up for Troy Davis, let me know, at least in the public, at least among us, it's not about race. You know what I'm saying? So we got to get that stick out of our asses and, you know, let people know if we see a case in which there's doubt that this guy, like, they did execute another dude, Rick Perry. I was reading this Rick Perry could have called and stopped this execution of a guy who was executed for killing somebody, even though he was only the getaway driver, and the person who actually did kill the person is serving life. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's the type
of shit we need to worry about.
Oh, no, I think this was another case, and I think this was a white guy, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. So that's the Wow.
So, yes,
well,
you know, I think we can all agree.
Well, then you get killed. Black men will get killed, as you've seen. I mean, there was a similar case which they had a white guy that was on death row, and he got exonerated with hell of a lot less evidence for his exoneration than the black guy. I mean, I just feel as though we need to pay attention. We can't play. I don't know exactly even how to say this, man. But we can't play everything equal across the board when it's not. You don't
That's
play.
What we're
you
saying.
Don't sit down at
we absolutely
table.
Agree there.
You
right.
can't sit down at the card table with a cheater and then play fair. You just can't do it, man. I can't explain it no better than that.
Right, and that's what we're saying, John, is that, you know, we can't look at everything the same across the board. You are absolutely right about that. There are some cases that have to be looked at a little bit more closer in detail, and we also must continue to obtain our objectivity in these cases, you know, because we can't just look at them all blanketly. You're absolutely right about that.
I have no problem with looking at anything objectively. This is what I do, you know. But at the same time, I'm not going to ignore factors just for a PC. I'm just not going to do it. I can't eliminate something just because there's no evidence of it. I've still got to have it there. And if everything else is eliminated and that's there, that's what it probably is. And that's what I'm saying in the Troy Davis case.
But, see, it do kind of seem like your idea is that the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. The fact that there is no evidence of something doesn't mean that it's not there. And in a court of law,
you're saying the same thing I'm saying. So what's the argument?
But you can't use that, though. And in a court of law, it's not
quite
what you know.
Explain that. Explain why I can't use that.
Because it's not what you know is what you can prove. That's what they're going to go by. It doesn't matter what you believe. You might be right. But if they can prove that you did it, no matter what you say, it doesn't matter what you believe the conspiracy is. They got you by the ball.
Well,
so
I'm not disagreeing with that. Now you're twisting my argument. What I'm saying is, if they can't prove anything, and if I can't prove anything, but we can't eliminate this one factor, then that's what it probably is. I'm not saying to convict on that. See, you're putting extra on what I'm saying. I'm not saying to convict or dismiss all that. You're putting extras on what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we can't X it out. You're saying X that out, which is ludicrous to me.
But if you can't
just
prove it,
just because you can't prove
it
does not mean you X it out, homie. That's all I'm saying.
All right,
does that make sense?
The justice system doesn't work by what you think, though.
I'm not understanding your argument. You're switching up the justices. Let me say it one more time. I'm not saying to convict off of something you cannot prove. I'm not saying to dismiss off of something you cannot prove. What I'm saying is not to eliminate it. Now, I hope you don't go back and say, well, the justice, I'm not addressing that. What I'm addressing is, again, what you cannot X out something which you cannot prove or disprove. That's a double negative. And you
but
keep
why
saying
would
it
even
seems like and all this kind of stuff. Now, who's assuming here?
But why would you even consider it if you can't prove it? It's like, you know what I'm saying?
I'm saying to consider it. That's exactly what I'm saying, to consider it.
But what they're saying is, why bother if you cannot prove it?
Yeah.
Why should it be considered?
Because it could be the reality of the situation. That's why.
But based on a theory and not necessarily facts?
Huh?
Again,
based on a theory and not necessarily the facts is what she said.
Okay, but I'm not saying it's facts. This is where they're getting confused. What I'm saying is, it's like the theory of evolution. We can't entirely prove it, but more than likely, that's how reality is created for the sense of a better explanation.
Actually, that's not necessarily true, because there have been studies performed, and there have been similarities proved that that shows that evolution is more likely a fact.
Again, you're not listening to what I said. Again, you're not taking everything I said. It's not entirely proven. Again, I'll say it again. It's not entirely proven that evolution is how everything started. There is some proof of evolution, of course, through DNA. Through archaeological finds and all that kind of stuff. But I'm saying it's not entirely true. It started off as a theory. But because everything else didn't work, scientists chose, well, the best explanation is this. And that's the thing I'm saying. Do you understand?
I hear what you're saying, but yeah, I can't jump on board 100%.
I understand. I respect that.
So there you go. There you go. I mean, you know, this was great today. A lot of great commentary. A lot of differing opinions, which is a good thing. And we're not going to always agree with each other, but we respect each other as individuals, and that's always a positive thing. But in regards to the Troy Davis case, like I said, it's just done and over with, and family, I teach them that. That's all the people that were involved in. The family of the slain officer, definitely my heart goes out to them because, again, they lost, you know, a father, they lost a husband, a brother, a son. So, again, you know, whether Troy had anything to do with that or not is irrelevant. You know, what's relevant is, you know, he's gone, you know, the police officer, and he didn't deserve to die. You know,
you're better than me because I have no feeling for the police. None. But their family
are people too, man.
I didn't say it wasn't people. I just have no feeling for them.
Yeah, well, my father was a police officer, and he died in the line of duty as well. So he wasn't shot or anything.
No, I hate to say it, but oh well. I had a lot of homies that got killed by the police. Sent off to life. I have a...
And this is what we're saying is that certain we. This is what goes back to what I'm saying. What I was saying before about us being able. Where is the empathy, regardless as to what our personal feelings are for or against? There must still. When did we lose that? When did we lose our ability to be empathetic and sympathetic just because? A certain situation. Just because you don't like the cops, you know.
Because I don't like them or what they done to me. Can we be specific?
Well, let's take both situations. Why is it that you feel like you cannot be empathetic or sympathetic just because of what another cop has done to you?
Because they're all a group and they all took an oath to support the law in which most of them don't. And they all and they are in brotherhood with each other. Again, I'll go to the point of which I said, in which you cannot sit down with the cheater and play fair. Just cannot do it. You can try if you want to and think you can go win. Good luck. I have
going
no
back to
apathy
the closing,
for
Kim.
That. Apathy for that. I'm sorry. He's a dead cop. Fuck him. I mean, that's just me.
I
disagree with you there.
I can't co-sign that, man.
Yeah, I won't co-sign that either.
Good. That's fine.
I mean, life,
you're
me, life is important to anybody, man. And, you know, and I don't know this man was a villain. So if the record said that he was trying to help a homeless man and he was killed, that man was doing something out of kind of his heart, and he lost his life in the process. So even if he is a cop, and you know what I'm saying, cops are villains, this guy didn't seem like he was a villain himself. I can't look at things as a conglomerate group here. If that's the case, then every time a black person did me, or that means I'm supposed to hate blacks. Similarly, I'm supposed to hate whites as well because I've had some run-ins with white people as well. If you look at everything like that, we'll all be screwed. And we'll never get along. And nothing
exactly.
will be because you'll have factions built as it's me versus you versus them. And we're not going to get anywhere like that. And besides, I went to school with cops. I knew cops. I known cops in the field. I know they're just like you and me. There's an asshole. There's a good guy. There's a good person. There's a bad person. Everybody has all these idiosyncrasies. Not all of them have the best training in the district, depending on what district they are in. And then you got some people who probably should never have been given the right to hold a gun and the authority to use it in the first place. So it's not always that this is a system designed against these people. I think you got individuals who do bad things, and those bad people bring spotlight to them as a whole, making them all look bad.
Right. That's just like saying that all black men are inherently evil, and that they should always be looked at and be discriminated against because of that. How fair is that?
Yeah.
Well, blackness isn't a brotherhood. Blackness is more like we were born into this. You weren't born into being a police officer. You took an oath to be a police officer. And if you took an oath to be a police officer to uphold the community and you do it, it's all good. But if in that you witness murders, in that you witness cases in which other people have been gone for 20 or 30, 40 years, in that you beat up people, in that you carry off crime, and then you don't even speak on it, you have a blue code of silence, I'm sorry. This is where I separate myself from all of y'all. I have no sympathy if you're part. That's just like you being a Klan member and, oh, but you're a good Klan member. Come on, man, stop it.
I disagree with that because you cannot prove that all cops are inherently evil and that they are inherently on the take.
I never said they were. There you go, putting words in my mouth. I never said that cops were all inherently evil. Where did you get that from? See, now you're making stuff up. Just to prove your
wow.
point. You have the nerve to talk about objectivity.
Wow, you just said that, John. You said that they all took an oath of brotherhood and that they are all murdering people. They're all standing by. They're all doing nothing.
That's not what I said. Yeah. Now you're twisting what I said. I said that but if you have an institution, if you have an institution which has done, which has, like, for example, When the housing market went down, who was the first to kick the people up out of their houses? The police.
That's not
what they're supposed to be upholding the community. Come on, man. Nobody should be inherently evil. Yeah. All of them and all that. Come on, stop it. Just to prove your point, you're making up stuff. I mean, stop that.
That's not necessarily true in all cases, though, John. There were police officers.
I didn't say all cases. There we go again. I did not make an absolute.
Let me finish my thought before you jump in and tell. What I'm saying is you made an indictment saying that the police were the first to kick people out. And I'm saying that there were police officers
there were.
Who actually refused to serve warrants and force people out of their homes.
There was. There was a sheriff that finally, after a while, did that.
There was more than
I
one.
I agree.
But my point to this is, as opposed to sitting down, and this is what kind of got me going when everything was said and done with Troy Davis, because we all sat back, we all started, you know, side-arming, we all played the Monday morning quarterback, and I stopped and I said, we need to do something. We need to start moving forward. You're not going to agree on your point of view. My thing is, take the John Henry Clark point of view and philosophy and say, we need to sit down and put together a plan. Stop waiting for people to tell us what to do, how to do it. Sit down and put
exactly.
together a plan. Everybody
mm-hmm.
bring their talents to the table. Whatever you do best, bring it out and put it in your community. Do something. Don't just sit back and do nothing. Do something. Put your talents and your expertise in your community. Educate people on the law so that when they do encounter police, they know exactly how to act, respond, and motivate other
yes.
people to do the right thing.
Right.
But if we sit back and do nothing, then we're just basically, and all we're going to do is sit back and talk about the negatives of what police do, what the government, what the trials do, then we're stagnant. We need to start moving together, and this is why I started challenging people, because I saw people posting, and I had a guy on my Facebook page who was basically, you know, he went to a next level. He started blaming the government as far as some of the other ills that were going on in the world. He talked about, you know, President Obama being a socialist pig and all this other stuff. And I was like, what are you doing in your community to educate people? Do something. We may not have a goal. We may not agree on everything, like I said. But when we can put together a plan, we can see that there's a path that needs to be taken. Some people will have to take different parts of that path in order to get there, but we're all on the same path moving forward. Let's stop dealing and dwelling on what happened and what, because there are a lot of points I agree with some of the things that Mandisa said, and I disagree with some of the things she said. I disagree with some of the things you said, John, and I heard some other things that I'm like, okay, back and forth, but where are we moving in this process? Because if we don't start saying, okay, I agree, we agree to disagree, let's start making a plan. We're on a platform. We're on Black Freethinkers Talk Show. Let's start this movement right here, right now. And, Kim, that's
mm-hmm.
why, you know, when I came and I jokingly said to you, you stole my idea, that's, you know, and I was joking about it, but I'm glad that you actually started it, because this is the movement that you need to stand up and do something. Move forward. We can all move forward. We are not going to agree. Let's agree to disagree, but let's stick to a plan and move forward. You can apply your thoughts and beliefs and start moving us forward. I will apply the same principles, and we may not agree on every step on how to take that step on the path, but we can start moving in a way that allows us to be progressive as opposed to being stagnant and complaining. That's what they
right.
expect. Stagnation and complaint, and that's all they expect of us.
Right.
Well, I'm one of those types where I don't care what they expect of us. I don't care what the other side does. I really don't. What I do is I care what we do. I make plans that apply to me and my community. A lot of people don't agree with my with how I look at things. But if they would step into my shoes and seen what I've seen, they might change, they might sway what they say. They might, you know,
vice versa.
You know, what?
And vice versa.
There it is. Like I said, there it is. You know, I have no, we have agreed to disagree here. I don't think anybody has really been that adversarial to where it's a point of disrespect. And I think that we are trying to make a plan right now to stop this from happening. But things happen. This is a pragmatic universe, man. Things happen. They just happen. I mean, there's just, we could sit here, there's been thousands and probably millions of people before us that said, well, you know, we need to come up with a plan. It's not going to be that easy. It's not going to be, because not only do you have to come up with a plan, but you also have to activate that plan. You also have to put that plan in motion. My plan may be different than your plan.
You know, a few years ago, somebody probably would have said that you can never get enough black people who are free thinkers and atheists into the same place and form a group and begin moving forward on awakening black people in the community from their tyranny of religion. And now you have not only black non-believers of Atlanta, but you have black atheists of America. You got black free thinkers. You got all kinds of organizations that are popping up because it can be done. Great things are never easy to do.
That is true.
Well, I mean, they also said there wouldn't be a black president, and there is. So, I agree with everything that you're saying, pretty much, except for when you put the absolute on me. But, you know, pretty much I agree with everything you're saying.
So the question would be, when do we, can we say, okay, it's said and done? I know you said, John, that you're moving, you're doing things in your community, and not everyone agrees with you. Not everybody's ever going to agree with you. And you know, I hate to compare it, but the fact of the matter is, during the civil rights movement, not everyone agreed with everyone as far as the path to take. You know, we look at it now and say that this one great movement. What about, let's start, you know, we, like I said earlier, we get to start having our own think tank. This is a platform here, right now, where you have people who have the opportunity, who have experience in different areas. We can start putting together our own think tank and saying, this is what we see we need to do. And from this approach, we're going to step on the path and invite others to step on the path with the understanding that, hey, we don't always agree. We're not always going to agree. But when we sit down and we have those meetings about the path that we're taking, we're going to sit down and agree to disagree, but we're going to put something together so that when we start moving, we can move forward with a group of people in a movement that says that it's, that has some validation to it, as opposed to just sitting back and waiting for, you know, like I said earlier, the next Al Sharpton, the next Michael Eric Dyson, Cornel West, Tavis Smiley, whoever wants to jump in front of a camera.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
I totally agree. Go ahead. I totally agree.
Now, I was just going to say, so yeah, moving forward, and you know, I totally agree with that. And what are we going to do? What are we going to do? So it's about education. It's about educating, disseminating education and information. It's about working together collectively, collaborating with one another, so that we can get the information out there. And we just have so many different people with so many different talents, so many different careers, so many different, you know, venues. And we need to get together and start working with each other. And actually,
right.
I did start a little think tank. And, you know, I kind of let it fall by the way, so I have to see it back up because I never lead the group. But I'll be happy to add you guys to it. I believe Mario, and I know Mandy's a part of it. And Eric, I'll be happy to add you to it. John, and let's go forward. You know, bring your ideas to the table. And we can work it out, hash it out. Again, there are going to be some times when your ideas you know, maybe, you know, they have a different view on it, but it's okay. It's not personal. We're all trying to reach the finish line. We're all out here trying to help these people. There are a lot of young people out here who are looking to us. And the reason why I know this is that, you know, I just received an inbox the other day from a 13-year-old asking me for help on how to talk to her family about her being a non-believer. I just believe that it's incumbent upon us to get out there and to help these babies, to help these children, so that we won't have any more young people in our community being subjected to wrongful indictment, wrongful incarceration, wrongful conviction. So, yeah, we have to go beyond, you know, what we have now. We take the information that we have, we take the precedent that has been set, and we work toward a better future for these young people, and even for people our age, because there are some people in our particular age group that just really don't know any better. They know the difference between right and wrong, but they may not know their rights. They may not know how to proceed. I mean, I tell people write motions to get their court information sealed. You know, to get their convictions sealed. You know, we couldn't necessarily get it overturned, but after a certain amount of time, certain cases can get it, you know, you can get it sealed and you can get it wrapped up. So, I mean, you have people out here that know how to do these things, that know how to look into the law and see that there are technicalities that you can use to your advantage to make your life a lot better. So we need to work on that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and I want to make sure that, you know, I think we can use the Troy Davis situation to put the spotlight on other possible injustices, you know, being done as well. You know, it shouldn't just start with him. It shouldn't be like, oh, well, we lost. Let's move on to other things and stuff like that. I think we need to keep moving forward on the idea of protecting civil liberties and protecting, helping people out who may have been wrongfully accused. And, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really investigate all that stuff myself. But another thing is I don't like when we make things only about us as in black people, as though somehow we can leave out a large chunk of the world and only focus on us. I know we do need to focus on us in some respects, but, you know, I'm not a person who wants to only, you know, focus on one thing. I believe that if, I don't care who it is, if we need help, if they need help, it should be about everyone as a whole.
I definitely agree with that.
I think that we also need to tell the truth about, organizations and institutions and get that information out there. I think Kim, you were talking about earlier about the Stop Snitching campaign and all this, and I wanted to address that too, is that, like, for example, going back to the police, is that the police in the black community especially should not give up all the information to the police. And I know you guys probably disagree with this, I understand. But this is the reason why. This is the logic behind this, okay? Is because they have programs in which they deal with, and this is all factual. You can look this all up for yourself, where they work with the federal government to trounce upon your civil rights. You know what I'm saying? To undermine this is, and they go through the churches, they go through certain institutions to do that. And if you look at the Asian communities had a Stop Snitching campaign way before black people did. They didn't allow nobody, the police, nobody involved with their business at all. And I think, and they've been able to, you know, kind of thrive doing that, is because they take care of their own. We can't keep on screaming police brutality and all this kind of stuff, but yet and still you go and talk to the groups. I mean, that just makes no sense. Until the police come with a program in which they're fair across the board, then that's when you should invoke them in the community, and not before, because with the documents of say, like, for example, the what is it called that they passed under George Bush? It escapes me right now. But anyway, after 9/11, they came out with documents in which in which they were invading our privacy and stuff like that. Man, that's very important. That's very important that we fight stuff like this on a ground level. And this is the reason why I support the Stop Snitching campaign. Unless, with the exception of, you know, you have crimes against humanity. You know what I'm saying? That's just my opinion, though.
Are you talking about the Patriot Act?
Yeah, the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's one of the things that you need to do when situations like the sensationalism of Troy Davis, you need to look at what's going on behind the scenes. And I'm not talking about specifically the case, but what other things are going on. Because a lot of situations happen, a lot of bills get passed, while we're focused on one particular thing and we're caught up in arguing about one particular thing, the government quietly passes laws and regulations. Like, for instance, the Patriot Act expired and was renewed this year. If I'm not mistaken, it was passed and renewed.
No,
we were
absolutely
dealing
right.
with other things. We were dealing with other things, and we weren't focused on some of the things that are going on. That happened, and a lot of this stuff happens on a global scale that we were focused on Troy Davis, and not saying that we shouldn't be, because that was a travesty, but you have other things that are going on in the world and other laws that are being passed and that are quietly pushed through, and then we wonder how we get caught up in this situation, and a lot of times it's because people don't take the time to pay attention to what's going on with our government and how they decide to deal with us.
I agree.
You know, another thing, we can't... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Mario, go ahead.
Another thing, we probably had to keep with using... I mean, because when we say they, it sounds like we're talking about one massive, super conglomerate, megalomaniacal organization. And each state is a different state. And each jurisdiction is a different state. So you got to fight a lot of these battles within your own territory because you can't really fight them nationally. But, the one thing I found to be uplifting about the Troy Davis situation and the fact the entire world was in sort of not entire world per se, but, you know, there were people all over the world who were supporting at least not executing the man, you know what I'm saying, at least. And to me, that made me feel good that a lot of people from the UK, I mean, I have some friends on Facebook who are in the UK, some, you know, a few of them Australia and whatnot, and they were really in on this, they were really paying attention, and when he was executed, they were really upset about it. And to me, that type of energy shows that the world is not complete without human beings who care about other human beings. Whether he's actually guilty or not, that's a whole other situation. The point is, a lot of people did not want this dude to die of the funkiness of the situation. You know what I'm saying? You know, and so that right there was a good thing that I would like to see that more. I would like to see more outpouring of support for truly important causes against humanity and stuff like that. I'd like to see the same energy directed towards, you know, starving and stuff like that, you know. And, you know, and I don't like it when, and especially I don't like it when my own people only care about only black causes, you know what I'm saying? If it's not
right.
a black person being affected by it, they don't really have much of an interest in it. That bothers me.
Well, you've got to also remember that a lot of, I've seen a lot of black people support a lot of the causes for, like, Latino or Mexican Americans, but also, for the most part, they don't support us. I don't like the fact that we put extra things upon our own people, but they won't do it with other people. And I don't like the fact that a lot of stuff that we do in our own race, we don't call out. We call out the stuff that's applied to other races. Like, it's unfair to this white guy, or it's unfair to this white woman, it's unfair to this Latino. Or the unfair it is, but in fact, most of the people from the other side will not speak for a lot of black people. They just won't. You can see it in the juries. You can see it with the police officers. You can see it across the country.
I can't exactly wholeheartedly agree with that, because that black woman who's accused, who's locked up, sent to prison for sending her kids to a different school, there were a lot of white people behind that. The girl, the woman in Atlanta who was trying to cross the street and her little boy got hit by a dude who should never have been behind the wheel to begin with. He got 3 months, and they were going to try to send her to jail for years. There were a lot of white people behind that as well. You know, it's a case-by-case basis normally, man. You know, I can't say that the other side, you know, is always against us.
Again, you guys have a bad habit of doing this, and so I'll express it again. I don't make absolutes like that. It's not. I don't say always. You know, I'm saying that a lot of the times with these other races, like I said, they do not. We'll speak up for them more than we'll speak up for our own. Not all of them, but in a lot of cases, most cases, this is what we do. So if you keep hearing always from me, I'm not hearing that out of my voice. You know what I'm saying? I think that's an add-on that you guys keep on doing. I think it's a defense mechanism because you're trying to play fair across the board. I understand that. But you can't play fair with people who don't play fair. It's just not, I can't, man, I wish I had the more of a talent of talking to say it in a different way. Maybe you guys would understand.
No, I understand perfectly what you're saying, John. And in some cases, yeah, you know, you can't necessarily play fair because they're not playing fair. You know, a friend of mine who's an attorney was talking about, you know, not this case, nothing related to this. Actually, it was a divorce case of a couple, a famous couple. And basically, she just made the comment on how this one particular, you know, African-American who was married to a non-African-American, she was saying, why is it that we're the only ones playing fair? And that happens sometimes. It happens sometimes when other people aren't playing fair and we do play fair. But the way that in many cases the system is set up, that if we try to play unfair, it's only going to make the situation 10 times worse than what it has to be or than what it already is. And I'm not saying that everybody plays unfair. That's not the case. But in the event, if that's not your mentality, just in general, I'll just use me as an example. For the most part, I play fair because that's what I've been taught to do. And when I'm dealing with people who aren't necessarily playing fair, or, you know, if the playing field is uneven, you know, I try to figure out what to do. But in some cases, some things just come across as extremely unfair. The odds are pit against you, and, you know, either you suck it up and deal with it, or you let it go and you move on. And not everything in life is fair, and it's not going to be fair in all cases. But to me, in my personal experience, playing fair has won more battles for me than playing unfair.
Well,
yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, is I play to win, regardless if it's playing fair or unfair. Now, if I know that somebody is playing unfair, I do either two things. This is, and I wasn't taught this. I was taught, like you, Kim, to play fair. But I learned through experience that, no, you can't do that because you will lose. And I guess the best way to describe this, if I'm in a game and somebody's playing unfair, either, number one, I don't play, or I play unfair with them. That way I have a chance to win. Because if someone has set forth a game in which they invented and they're playing unfair, regardless if you win, I mean, if you lose and it's 10 times worse, you still lose. So it doesn't matter.
What about the situation?
Yeah, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to ask, because a lot of times we tend to confuse them being unfair with we're not really understanding the rules of the game as far as entering this certain arenas. We go into it and we don't know what the rules are, so we go into it ignorant, and all they're doing is playing by the rules, knowing that we don't know the rules, so they use the loopholes, they use the tactics to throw us off, and then we end up losing out because we don't know. And I want to use a quote that Chuck D put in when he was in the song Welcome to the Terror Dome. It was like, in the game of fool without the rules. And a lot of us enter this stuff and we don't know the language, we don't know the rules, we don't know how to properly address these systems. And sometimes it seems like they're playing dirty, but they're, you know, to them they're basically saying, I can get away with it because I know how this works. And we refuse to understand and take the time to know the process. But when you see someone who does know it, like a Kim who comes in and starts talking about putting information out that requiring logical thought and process, Kim is automatically said, you know, Kim is a troublemaker because she knows the rules. She knows how this is played, and she's putting logic, she's applying logic and reason to it and trying to inform and educate other people. But now that I'm trying to inform and educate, you're a troublemaker, you're not, you know, you're a misfit, you don't really belong. People shouldn't listen to you.
I totally agree with that, man, because it's like, you know, somebody told me, and this person used to be a cop, they also used to be in the military, you know, say a lot of times, you know, the procedure is what they're going to go by. Like, you got, you know what I'm saying, a black guy or whoever who draws on, you know, says he's surrounded by cops, he draws. Procedure is now you're authorized to use deadly force. It doesn't say, hey, okay, he's drawing, I'm going to shoot, then you shoot, and then let's let Gray shoot after me. No, it's saying you're supposed to pull the trigger, now that this guy has used deadly force. So we're going to see them shooting the black guy 50 times when nationality, that's actually proper police procedure. So now you have to see, now you got to have to challenge them on the procedure. And in their mind, they are playing fair because that is the way that things are supposed to go. And on our mind, we're seeing a social injustice when maybe he was in the wrong. And a lot of times the rules are there. If you learn the rules, like he said, if you learn how to play the game, you can play fair and still win. But, you know, as long as you don't properly know your rules, you know what I'm saying, knowing that you're right doesn't mean anything. You know what I'm saying?
I agree with him, but you took it to another level, man, which I'm just saying, like, okay.
I wasn't contradicting you, man.
Huh?
I wasn't contradicting you. I was just saying I was agreeing with him.
Well, but you took it to a whole another level to where it's like, okay, just because what they say is right makes it right. That's what I'm getting out of what you're
saying. No, I didn't say that.
I didn't say you said it. I'm just saying that's what I'm getting out of what you said. Because whether you know, I'm like this, man. Okay, and I might be wrong about this one, so I'm going to put a slight disclaimer on this, okay? But I'm like, man, if you set forth some rules, why are your rules all of a sudden my rules? You know what I'm saying? I'm like, I'll tell you what, homie. I don't want to play your game. No, you're going to have to play my game. Well, what if I say I don't want to play your game? Nope. This is the law. This is what you got to do. Well, no. I don't care who you are. Who made you in judgment of me? I'm not going to go with it. It's just like religion, you know? If they put forth some rules and they say, hey, you go by this to control you. Laws are almost like religion. And I'm not saying to be a total anarchist, but to a certain extent, I'm like, man, wait a minute, man. No. I don't have to learn your game. As a matter of fact, I will do more inventing my own game and having you play by my game because I know I'll probably win it. This is how my mind works. And again, I put a disclaimer on that because everybody probably can't do it, everybody can't, you know, think that way. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, but the thing is that we're not the ones who make the rules. We're not the one who invented the game and established the rules. So as it sits right now, the game has already been developed and the rules have already been established. So we have to learn the rules of the game. Now, there may be a time in which we can add additional rules or modify rules that are there or have certain rules thrown out because of whatever.
But in the meantime, until we're able to create our own game and our own rules, we have to abide what's in front of us.
I don't necessarily, okay, this is where my disclaimer comes in. I don't necessarily agree with that, Kim. I believe that
okay.
we have the power right now to put forth our own rules if we really will want to. It's just, what are we going to sacrifice to do it? I mean, we just got finished having a nice conversation of agreeing all across the board saying, hey, we need to put the information out there. We need to have
that's
a plan. Well, to me, the plan is not to go with their plan, number one. And in order, because, Kim, if you put forth all this information out there to these people, they're going to trouble you. They're going to call you a troublemaker. And they're going to lie and say that you are not playing by the rules when you are. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand perfectly, but it doesn't matter what they call me. It's the only thing that matters is what I answer to. And
I agree.
Even if they call, even if they call me a troublemaker and make up all these lies, the truth, you know, when you go into a court of law, truth is an absolute defense. When you have the truth and the facts behind you, whether people want to accept it or not, it is the truth and those are the facts. Whether they accept it or not, again, that's on them. But they can't say that they weren't told. And that's pretty much my premise. I told you. Whether you accept it or believe it or not, that's on you. And I'm not going to stress myself or give myself an aneurysm trying to convince you one way or the other. I just want to be able to walk away from this situation knowing that I disseminated the information to the people. Now, whether they take it up and do something with it, that's on them. But in the meantime, I'm going to do what I need to do to disseminate information, to educate the people, and to get out here and start up, again, my own foundation and work with other foundations and help the people in the community. Again, be solutions-based. Just because I offer it, that doesn't mean that they have to take it, but they won't be able to say that they were not told.
Well, they'll
you
be
know,
able to say
you know,
it, but it won't be true. I agree with you. I'm sorry, I interrupted somebody. Go ahead.
You know, I remember, did you see the black dude who moved into that upscale white neighborhood and got a $300,000 house for $15 because he knew a rule that they didn't, and they was pissed off about it?
Yeah.
He had those people pissed off. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, he took the time to learn something that they didn't take the time to learn. And, I mean, what can you say? You can't beat him because he went by the law, you know? I think the law is a double-edged sword. If you know how to use it, you can use it both for and against, for you and against other people. That's why, you know, like, even though, let's say, like, Phil Spector was convicted of killing that woman, he may not do no time. That billionaire dude from some other country who raped that woman, that motherfucker got off. And he pretty much admitted he did it. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, the law is a devil, man. You got, if you can, I understand what you're saying, and I can agree with you on that, you know what I'm saying? But I also believe that, you know, like, it's like you can't go into Texas Hold'em not knowing how to play the game and still expect to win. You know,
unless you don't play it at all.
But yeah, it's wrong. Yeah, that's another thing. Yeah.
But
exactly.
If you don't, I just don't play a game I don't know. That's just me, though.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I understand that.
Exactly. Well, guys, we're down to the last 40 seconds, and I would like to thank all of you guys, everyone who called in today, everybody who participated in the chat room, everyone listening to the archives. We thank you. We appreciate you, and, you know, the support is welcomed. And, again, great conversation, guys. Again, differing opinions, but that's okay. You know, we welcome that because, again, this is how we educate people, because some of the information that was given today, I'm definitely going to go and look it up, and you never know. You know, you may influence my opinion on certain things. So, again, I just want you all to keep calling in, keep expressing yourselves, and most importantly, have a lovely rest of the weekend, guys.
Yes, same to you, and thank you very much.
Oh, sorry about that.
Go.
All right. Good evening, everybody.
Okay. Have a good night.
See you next week.
Bye.